Hello, I'd just like to agree with the lady that all politicians are monkeys. They've got no original thinking. The idea of 15-minute cities has come from the World Economic Forum. This is nothing about clean air. It's all about the god of climate change and net zero. So it's nothing to do with clean air. It's just to control people, minimize their travel. Oil is actually a scarce commodity. It's becoming harder and harder to take oil out of the ground. It's costing more. So it's nothing but a scheme to keep the wealth in the hands of few by forcing everybody else not to drive and emotionally blackmailing us with the climate. Is it 10 years to live? 5 years to live for the planet? How many times have we heard it? Al Gore, Prince Charles, now King Charles? All of them. So they're all liars, to be honest. Yeah. So that's the issue.
Yes, it's Friday. Okay, yes. Come on down, Martin Summers. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 29th of September 2023, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft Arts Centre in Bristol, on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Anything, please, but Google. So Albert Pike's accelerationist strategy is clear to anyone with eyes to see and ears to hear. The so-called solutions to every crisis, climate, migrant, COVID, economic, Ukraine, are designed to make things better. As the mass media is spinning them, actually they're Armageddonist policies designed to make every crisis worse. UN Sustainable Development Goals supposed to address the climate crisis and wealth inequality, are they really just a race to the bottom undoing centuries of progress and bombing the developed world back to the Stone Age? Helping navigators through the Fourth Reich Matrix, the world's fourth industrial revolution, and of course I mustn't forget to thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Today, part one, we'll be looking at the press and the censorship of Russell Brown from the point of view of the editor of The Guardian, Kath Viner, who popped up on the BBC's media show. It was actually the BBC's BBC media show plus The Guardian media show this week. No real discussion with the owners of Rumble or anything like that. No, it's just Katie Razzle chatting to her mate Nick Robinson, former head of the Young Conservatives at the BBC. BBC talking to themselves again. We've also had a bit of a debacle at something called the Kumba Project here in Bristol. We've got all sorts of West Indian institutions here, the Malcolm X Centre, and St Paul's Carnival, and also the Kumba Project now has been served with notice by Bristol City Council to go. They've got to go. They've just got to go. They don't like them. They don't like the people that are running it, and they won't talk to them. They've just been told leave. So we'll have the latest on that. Good old Ken Loach, the film director, he has been on the BBC this week talking about Gerard Winstanley and the Diggers, although I have a few bones of contention with him about it. It's fascinating to hear this important bit of history from the English Civil War being aired on national radio. We've got, over from last week, we've got our little look at nuclear weapons and also nuclear safety down at Devonport, the dockyard there. Where there are nuclear subs, and I suppose it's the southern base for the Faslane nuclear base and Coalport up in Scotland, which are where the nuclear submarines are based. It's a pity the nuclear submarines. Apparently that's why we're not allowed to have them coming into our ports like Bristol or Newcastle anymore. It's because the nuclear, you know, so there might be a nuclear contamination, so we can't have them coming into British ports anymore. So thank you very much, Royal Navy. It'd be nice to have some old diesel-powered ones if we're allowed to do that, if Greenpeace will let us. Anyway, in part two, really majoring this week and having a good old look at this fiasco over in Canada, which is actually rather more than just a fiasco, with Justin Trudeau inviting some former Waffen-SS soldier to speak to the Canadian Parliament and then giving him a standing ovation. Is this just a mistake, or is there more to it than that? And we'll be finishing off by looking at the School of Lucifer in London. So Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, first by the telecoms cartel, then by Ofcom, and us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, but not yet cancelled here, thank God. Martin, let's start though by looking at some of these continuing problems with anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. We had a good old look last week at Keir Starmer and his role before, really before he even entered politics, before he was a Director of Public Prosecutions as a lawyer. And his role working with Dave Morris and Helen Steele, both of which I've met over the years, and interviewed Dave Morris particularly several times over things like housing. He's a brilliant community activist, the McLibel pair. But it does it's rather suspicious, isn't it, that Keir Starmer sort of earned his spurs as a human rights lawyer, left-wing person. But then once he comes into power, he seems nothing of the sort. This is something I think, clearly, it's not just the Labour Party doing this. We've got Rishi Sunak, who's come straight out of Goldman Sachs, haven't we?
Well, I mean, the establishment obviously takes a lot of effort to make sure that the kind of people who end up with any power are the sort of people that are acceptable to them. And in a sense, Keir Starmer was absolutely upfront by saying, you know, I'm part of the establishment. Rishi Sunak the same. He went to Winchester College. He was the head boy. He went to Oxford. He went to work for Goldman Sachs, had a very successful meteoric career, quite wealthy families, married even wealthier family. I mean, these people are ambitious and they're part of the establishment. And it's just part, I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying that's what it is.
The way this actually affects policy is that there's this almost, well, there's almost no opposition. There's almost no debate right now.
Well, what happens is there is a pseudo debate, but when it comes to anything important, it's impossible to get it done. Look what happened. I mean, the best attempt that we could have made in recent years was the Corbyn insurgency inside the Labour Party. And it did actually frighten the establishment quite a bit. And then they reacted to it by squashing it with determination. And they're now quite happy that we're back to square one and that they can carry on stitching things up as in their usual fashion. And if you want to change that, you've got, you know, it's an uphill struggle because they've got all the cards.
There's a big hoo-ha this week, and I think maybe we'll have our first clip on that, about the new, I think it's called Rose Bank, 300 million barrels of oil, at least, sitting under the North Sea. And Rishi Sunak has said, yes, we need this oil. So there is this kind of battle over energy going on. The Labour Party, it's basically not really saying much about it, not saying that they shouldn't be doing it or they should. But obviously this is there's a massive debate about this. If we really do go for net zero, surely it's absolutely absurd to be digging out another 300 million barrels of oil from the North Sea. It just doesn't seem to make sense, this discussion.
Well, it doesn't. And of course, you've got two levels on it. One is the kind of political level. So Sunak, especially after what happened in the Uxbridge by-election, which was the only, you know, glimmer of hope for the Tories, has concluded, and of course that a lot of the Tory press are very opposed to the whole net zero concept. So an easy manoeuvre for...
Well, to be fair, is that they're reflecting the voters.
Well, yes, OK.
They don't want to lose their cause.
Well, yes, OK. So in other words, on one level, this is a political discussion about whether you can win elections and how to win them. And at one level, the Tories, when they had the COP22 summit or whatever, they were trying to, you know, that was in Britain, and they were trying to take the lead. Yes, we're going to take a lead on all of this. And they were trying to make political capital out of that. Now, of course, there is quite a lot of resistance to this policy, especially amongst Tory voters. And so, therefore, they're rowing back on it because what the calculation is that Keir Starmer will be forced by his own side to oppose taking this oil from the North Sea, because that's the position of the Green Party, for example, and many, many left-wing people for whatever reason. So he will then be forced to defend, which is, as you say, he's not saying much, because he may just decide that he doesn't want to do it either if there's enough resistance to it. Then we come back to the really serious point of whether we should or shouldn't be doing it, really. And the thing about it is that even if they go ahead and do it, it won't make any difference to the cost of living crisis right now, this minute, because it just won't. It'll take years to come to fruition.
Anyway, so actually, isn't the oil price set globally? So,
well, the oil price is set by the international market.
This is not going to bring the price of oil down, is it, having this coming through?
No, but you could argue, but at least we've got our own oil there, and if there's a war or whatever, there it is. Although, of course, the pipelines could be attacked, as we saw a year ago with the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which was a gas pipeline, but that was attacked. These kind of infrastructures are in fact terribly vulnerable. Yeah. So if there's a war, they get blown up.
Well, it makes it very sensible to have your own supply of oil. I mean, I think it's just insane. But anyway, to just say, oh, well, we're just going to continually import all the things we need. I mean, this was one of the
main... Well, if you're going to import it instead, then of course, that's the point. But of course, the argument is that everybody should, you know, net zero and all the rest of it. Now, I'm not saying I agree with it or disagree with it, but you can see that the politics of it are becoming sharper.
Anyway,
because the Greens will definitely be pushing for saying we shouldn't take this oil out of the North Sea.
Let's have a listen to this.
And, you know, Tory right will be saying, yes, we should.
Rosebank announcement yesterday.
Environmental campaigners have hit out at the government's decision to approve the largest untapped oil field in the UK. Rosebank is around 80 miles west of Shetland and is estimated to contain 300 million barrels of oil. The companies behind it and ministers say it will create hundreds of jobs and raise billions of pounds. But climate activists say it's reckless and inconsistent with the UK's 2050 net zero target. Our business editor, Simon Jack, has our first report.
Rosebank will be the largest new oil field development in decades. When it's operational, it will contribute about 8% of the UK's current daily oil and gas use. The government argues that even the 2050 net zero target acknowledges that fossil fuels will provide 25% of the UK's energy needs, and that it makes no sense to import what we need when there are resources in our own waters. Alex Grant is the UK head of Norway's state-owned oil company Equinor, which owns 80% of Rosebank.
If we don't develop Rosebank, we will still use exactly the same amount of oil in the UK. Not one less drop will be consumed, but we will import it from somewhere else where the emissions will be likely over double of the emissions of Rosebank. And the environment doesn't care which country the emissions come from.
Well, that chap's making a pretty good point there, isn't he, Martin? He's saying that actually if we import this from somewhere else, it's going to be far worse for the environment.
Well, I think that's a fair point. And, of course, I would argue that you can't necessarily get to net zero when you're trying to expand the global economy to get people out of poverty. It's interesting, as I didn't realise that Rosebank is actually owned by the Norwegian nationalised companies, because one of the things you could say, if we are going to develop it as a national resource, it ought to be owned by the British government, which of course is the case in the Norwegian sector of the North Sea. And then of course policy decides what you're going to do with that. Whereas of course if you've got privately owned companies, they push to develop it anyway, because they just want to make the money out of what they're doing, and that's their goal.
Politically though, we've had a few recent by-elections, haven't we? All of them, apart from Uxbridge, lost by the Conservatives. Most people saying that was due to Sadiq Khan's ULEZ charge, that people stayed with the Conservatives. I mean, it's almost as if the whole country just wants to leave them behind. But there is an interesting by-election coming up next week, 5th of October, which is Margaret Ferrier from the SNP. I think she got told to stand down because she went on a train return trip somewhere during COVID, which she wasn't allowed to do. So obviously she's not capable of being an MP anymore. So, but this is the SNP, and it'll be interesting to see how well they do after all of the problems there's been with Nicola Sturgeon being removed and, well, effectively, well, allegations anyway, of criminality at the very top of the SNP.
Well, it is interesting because it's one that Labour have to win, really. Because they're within striking distance of taking it. It used to be their seat. It's on the north of Clydebank, which I know quite well. And it used to be solidly Labour. And then it went to the SNP during, you know, the 90s. And if the Labour Party can't win it back, then they've got, you know, they're not going to make any progress in Scotland at all. They have to win it. Similarly for the SNP, they could lose it. But that won't necessarily be the end of the situation, because the majority they've got is relatively, small. But I think the SNP are coming out fighting, because one of the things that happened this week is that they've opened a drug consumption place in the centre of Glasgow where people can go and legally take drugs under medical supervision, which is opposed by the national government in London, but they've not moved against the decision in Scotland, and the SNP are saying we want to decriminalise drugs in Scotland just like they've done in Portugal in the 1980s. And that's clear red water between the SNP and the Labour Party. Keir Starmer is not going to come out with anything like that, because he's a safety first establishment chap, as we were saying earlier. So the SNP are going to try and attack him from the left about drugs policy, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, so Margaret Ferrier, not entirely clear whether she's still actually, she's going to be able to stand as an SNP candidate. Is she standing again?
Told to stand down, and the SNP have got a new candidate whose name I've forgotten.
Well, this is interesting, isn't it? Because surely, in principle, if this whole, the Recall of MPs Act passed in 2017, if the party decides they don't like you, then you can't stand again as that MP.
Well, that's an internal matter for the parties. Boris Johnson wasn't allowed to stand in Uxbridge. That's an internal matter for the Conservative Party, just as it's an internal matter for the SNP. They could, if they wanted to, put her up again, but they've decided not to because he's had to retire.
Boris wasn't wanting to stand, was he?
Well, okay, well, no, I don't
know.
Well,
that's not a correct comparison. For example, she has stood as an SNP MP. Nicola Sturgeon, what did Nicola Sturgeon say about her? Something like the worst mistake or the worst decision imaginable or something. Which is obviously not. This is an exaggeration by Sturgeon. Just going down on a train and back again. You know, what, has she killed loads of people?
She didn't just do that. She was going around pretending, you know, she was basically ignoring the regulations. And therefore, and don't forget, the SNP had taken quite a strong line and everybody obeying the regulations.
Weren't quite a lot of people obeying the regulations? Judges, for example, flying around the world?
I can't remember what, it was either internal SNP decision that she had to stand down, or it was a decision by the Parliament itself.
I think Parliament that decided it's a recall petition by the local people.
That's it. So that's why
she's not allowed to stand again.
The SNP could have stood her again, but they didn't because she'd lose. So they didn't bother. What's the point?
Yeah, well, it'd be interesting to see, because I'd like to see someone like her actually fighting back a bit.
Well, she's saying as an independent.
And saying, well, actually, I think what I did was, there was no real danger in what I did, and the rules were stupid or something
that. She can't stand as an independent now because it's too late, but if she wanted to do that, she could have done it.
There's all sorts. Let's have a look now at... we had a good old listen, I think, to the Russell Brand story last week, and every time I see I saw Private Eye with their cover this week, it's all anti-Russell Brand. It's like the whole press is just now used to kind of smear people and have a go at people, and it makes me like Russell Brand more. In fact, it makes me want to watch his stuff more, because it seems like he's hated by the establishment so much he must be saying something right. And one of those people who's been discussing this this week is a lady called Kath Viner. Now, before we hear from her, do you want to say something about her? Because she took over as Guardian editor from the Alan Rushbridger, didn't she? And Alan was, I seem to remember, when, because he was quite a supporter of Julian Assange, and the Guardian was at the time, was forced by the security services to use a sledgehammer to smash up a hard drive down in the basement of the Guardian. And the Guardian doesn't seem to have been the same since.
No, I think Kath Viner is very definitely... I mean, Rusbridger is not entirely to be trusted in my view, but Kath Viner very definitely... don't forget, the intelligence services are very interested in the formation of liberal opinion. They put a lot of effort into getting the right liberals. They control the conservative. You know, the conservatives are on message anyway. So there's, you know, they don't spend much time trying to steer them. It's very important to get the liberal opinion in the right space. On things like Ukraine, for example, I've stopped reading the Guardian's reports on the Ukraine because it's just straightforward MI6 propaganda. And you know, Luke Harding, who used to be their Russia correspondent, is privately educated mate of loads of people in MI6. And you can see it's just obvious that they are definitely under the influence. That doesn't mean that other articles in The Guardian aren't worth reading, but the foreign affairs stuff has become execrable in my view.
I think we had a pretty good discussion with Simon Killane last week, the former Wiltshire councillor, talking about the way he was destroyed by the local press and in the local press. By various procedures in a similar way to Russell Brand was. But, I mean, his argument, I think, is very good, is that you cannot put the genie back in the bottle. This whole idea of the internet and social media, there's a sort of almost a frenetic attempt to cancel people like Russell Brand, but he's got a massive following amongst young people, which is only encouraged by this sort of behaviour by the mainstream press.
Well, I hope that's so. I mean, if he has allegations to answer, which are criminal allegations, that should be investigated. Otherwise, people have got to put up or shut up. It's all very well saying, we have been told this, that and the other happened. Okay, so what? You've been told that, you've reported that. That doesn't mean that he's guilty of anything unless he's been convicted of wrongdoing. And if he hasn't been convicted of wrongdoing, this is just a smear campaign, isn't it?
It is. And wasn't it interesting that the chairman of the Commons Committee that was writing to Twitter, TikTok, X, the rest of them, saying, we think you should stop Russell Brand being able to monetize his channel and maybe just take his channel down, also turns out to be the wife of one of the former bosses of Brigade 77.
That's right. And isn't it interesting is that what they're really upset about is what he's saying about the war in Ukraine and COVID and so on. And that's what they want to shut him up about. They're not really that interested in what he does. If he wasn't saying those things, they wouldn't really care about what he'd done in his private life. It would hardly be an issue, would it?
No. Let's have a listen then to Katie Razzle and her BBC media show, which completely shuts the rest of the media out, apart from The Guardian and the BBC, talking to themselves here.
I wanted to bring in Catherine Viner here from The Guardian. Let's think back to what's already been said, particularly when it comes to Rumble and the parallel economy. What is your take on all of that?
I think it's no doubt that Rumble makes money from distributing misinformation. I mean, it trades in conspiracy culture. And I think it's whether you care about what that does to society. I do. And I think they're clearly a publisher and they're not accountable, they're not transparent, and so they should have some of the obligations that are placed on news organisations.
Is that the price of free speech, though?
I mean, as Nick said, if that is distributing really dangerous information that is disrupting society and disrupting people's lives, I think some regulation would be relevant.
And what about Libby Emmons' point, you know, looking at what Caroline Dynage did in writing to Rumble and other platforms? I'm just interested in what you made of that. You know, some people might say it felt like politicians taking a stance on free speech and who should have a media profile.
I know what you mean, but I think Rumble is a class apart. And, you know, we don't want the foxification of news in this country. British TV channels are very trusted for news, and I think it would be a real loss to disrupt that too much.
And it's important to say at this point that, of course, Russell Brand denies all the allegations against him.
At The Guardian, what we try to do is stretch, you know, the amount of opinion, the perspectives that we offer. But it has to be based in facts. It has to be fair. I think, you know, it has to be accountable. I think news organisations have to be transparently funded. Otherwise, it can lead to a very, very dangerous path, I think. I think it's about platforms taking responsibility for what they publish, for facts, for processes for complaints, for processes for taking down illegal content, the sort of things that news organisations do to show that they're accountable and transparent.
And what does better for The Guardian? Is it your deep dive analysis, for example, into a news story, or is it opinion? I mean, what does the market want? Are we getting to a stage where people do want more opinion?
Absolutely not. I think that might have been true perhaps a decade ago, but I think people have a craving for good information, investigative reporting, serious reporting. That's what we find drives most support to The Guardian by a very long way.
You've all been listening to the media show on BBC Radio 4. We'll be back next week. You can also hear us again, repeated if you'd like to hear it again, on BBC Sounds. But for now, thank you so much for listening. Goodbye.
Good old Katie Razzle there, telling us all about how wonderful their media show is. The only trouble is, Martin, that what they're doing there is they are just literally digging a hole for themselves, because the reason that people don't trust The Guardian anymore, they don't buy The Guardian anymore, that it's had to be propped up by these private equity firms, etc., is because they don't trust it. And they're saying, oh, well, actually, people do trust us. They love us. They're completely deluded, it seems to me. So conspiracy culture, apparently, this is what Rumble trades in. But actually, if you go to Rumble, I mean, the idea is that these editors need to decide what we can and cannot see. And they're only basically showing us anti-Russian stuff. It's kind of almost psychopathic, the idea that Russia is the target of all their, all the, you know, has done all the evil things in the world. They're trying to keep a lid on it all, aren't they?
They are, and I think it's... I mean, it's absurd in a way, because we know, we all know what the general rules are. The BBC and RT, when it was allowed to broadcast in this country, when you've got a public sector, public service broadcaster, they are obliged to fulfil certain standards, which others are not expected to do. The Guardian, for example, is, it prides itself on being independent, but in actual fact, it's got its view. And that's okay. It has its view. And nobody can tell The Guardian what it should publish, because it's a supposedly newspaper rather than a TV station. TV stations are under more, and radio, certain radio stations are under more regulation than newspapers. I mean, if you're going to argue that everybody's got to, everything's got to be fair and undiscriminatory, well, you've got to have the same rules for everybody. That includes the Daily Telegraph, the Daily Mail, the Spectator, the Express. They've all got to give Jeremy Corbyn a fair go. And everybody's got to give everybody a fair go. That's the kind of rules you could have. If you're not going to have that, anybody can say what they like. Because in the, you know, we talk about the French Revolution or the American Revolution. In the American Revolution, people produced pamphlets about how wicked King George was and how evil his counsellors were and how we'd have to go to war against them to liberate the country. And that was freedom of speech. There were loads of pamphlets and they all disagreed with each other and so on and so forth. And that is freedom of speech. Now, with the internet, you really cannot stop people finding anything they want to find. The RT has been banned from the mainstream media here. You still can't get it on the internet because it's been banned by the, you know, the
we have our ways.
Yes, but in any case, in the real world now, people in the rest of the world, for example, can see RT. In South Africa, for example, people can watch RT in English and they can find out anything they want to find out from it. And the what they're doing here is they're trying to suggest that there's only one narrative which is respectable and acceptable, which is the liberal conservative narrative of the BBC and The Guardian, and everybody else is either too right-wing or too left-wing. Now, I understand that the BBC has a very difficult role to perform, as all national broadcasters do. The Australian Broadcasting Corporation is owned directly by the Australian government. And therefore, people legitimately say, you've got to give everybody a fair crack of the whip here. Other things, like the Murdoch Press, can say whatever it likes. She talked there about we don't want the foxification of British media. Well, that's we've got it already in the Tory press. They're under no obligation to stick to the facts, and they don't. And I've had loads of run-ins with them over the years where they just make stuff up about things I've been involved in, including damaging people's reputations and all sorts of things. And there's no comeback. There just isn't, unless you're wealthy and you can sue for libel.
So overall, this whole idea what they're basically saying is they think that something should be done about Rumble, and that it should be some kind of complaint system where Rumble can be taken out, fined, and can be told how to do it. Now, this seems to me very much like our discussion we were having last week about the online safety bill and attempts to literally close down the internet. So there is a narrative which is out there in the mainstream press, which some people listen to, less people trust. But there is also lots of different voices out there online, and it seems that there is an attempt to just shut that down. But Rumble is the main target of it right now.
Well, also, of course, the internet is international. So it's very hard. You can pass rules against things in Britain, but, you know, people can easily just access it from another IP address somewhere else. And, of course, if we're going to have, as I said earlier, if we're going to have rules that people have got to obey in terms of balance and giving fair voices to everybody, then that's got to apply to the Murdoch press. They can't just push Tory propaganda. If the internet's not allowed to do that, then the mainstream newspaper's certainly not allowed to do that.
Well, they're not talking about that there, are they?
No, they're
talking
not.
About the Guardian and the BBC.
Why aren't they talking about the Murdoch press being held to account? They're not. They're talking about Rumble being held to account because Rumble is doing stuff they don't like. The Tory press is accepted as a kind of fact of life that nobody can do anything about. They can come out with anything they like. The Sun makes up all sorts of nonsense every day.
I mean, it seems to me so much of what goes on in the press now is pointing at someone saying, we don't like them, neither should you.
Well, you can do that, but you're not right. You're not, in theory, you're not supposed to be able to close people down. Although, what, as we know, what really happens is by demonetizing people and using algorithms to prevent people finding what they're looking for, the media environment is controlled. It's probably more controlled in Britain than it is in Russia today. In modern Russia is actually a bit of a free for all in terms of what people are allowed to say compared to us.
Moving on to another subject which has been quite well reported in our local press here. The Kumba Centre supporters vow to block council eviction of a community lifeline. A packed 11th hour public meeting in St Paul's last night voted to back the board members who have been running a lifeline community centre and pledged to physically block any attempts by council officials to take over the building. Supporters of the Kumba Centre, spelt K-U-U-M-B-A, Kumba Centre, said they have soldiers ready to sleep here to safeguard the space. Now, why has it come to this? Board members who've been running the Arts and Community Centre in Hepburn Road for the past 12 years have been told they have to hand over possession of the building to Bristol City Council. But more than 100 members of the St Paul's and Stokes Croft, that's us folks, communities came together last night, Wednesday, to express support for them and pledge defiance against what one community activist called an attempted coup by the council. Well, that was me, folks, actually. But anyway, Martin, this is pretty sad, isn't it? The West Indian community here are feeling bullied out by the council. There's also been, under George Ferguson, when he was mayor, the Carnival Committee were told they had to resign and reapply for their jobs, effectively. And the same with the Malcolm X Centre. So this is the last of the three big West Indian cultural centres and cultural events, which is now the council are saying we want to be able to decide who runs this, not you.
Well, I understand what I don't know enough about the issues to know what the council is alleging they supposedly have or haven't done.
Well, apparently, in a nutshell, it's in the article, and I'll put a link to that up on the show page. What happened was, back in 2016, 2017, the former board collapsed, and so what the people who were actually managing the place did is they formed a new board, they informed the council of what had been going on, and they said, we've now got a new board, and we will be running this for the community, and they've been doing so ever since. And now the council have said, oh, that procedure that you did back in that time is no good. We're going to decide who's going to run this place now.
Well, the $64,000 question is, A, who owns the building, and B,
the council funds
yeah. Cumber?
Nobody. It funds itself.
Does it?
The council are actually funding it, yeah.
Okay, so they're saying that's our building. We don't give you any money, but it's our building, so that's what they're saying.
Yeah. So anyway, there was a big meeting which I was at, and it'll be interesting to see how this all goes, because the council's basically being told, we want you out. So there were some quite interesting contributions from the floor. I put my two apron thin, really, saying what I just said then. So let's have a listen to one of the other people who was speaking at that meeting on Wednesday evening here in the sort of boundary between Stokes Croft and St Paul's in Hepburn Road.
We are at war, right? And that is it. On a racial injustice, on socioeconomics, on regentrification, 101 different ways is our community being attacked daily, okay? Now, I can go into the history of Kumba, but all I can say is when I came here as an innocent, sweet 26-year-old, Dr. George, from Northwest, this place held me, yeah? As well as Malcolm X Community Centre. And I know already what this place has done for many, many others, okay? We cannot lose another one, okay? We've lost enough already. So we, that's a collective we, need to find a way to move this forward in a position of strength, love, peace and unity for all. So that's me done.
Well, you can see, Martin, there's a pretty strong sense that they don't want the council weighing in. The place is already very successful. They have events there every week. They also have a whole bunch of workshops where local young people can get started and things like that. It's being run very well. The council's not saying you're not running it well. It's just saying we want you out.
Well, I'll be interested to know what the council's rationale is for this.
Well, there isn't any. And well, also, they have refused to discuss anything with the present people.
Well, the obvious
it.
Thing that I would do if I was involved in the Cumber Centre, which I did, I've been to meetings there in the past, but obviously I've not been heavily involved in it, is the first thing is you go to the local councillors for the area and say, well, what's your position on this?
Well, they haven't replied, the local councillors, apparently.
Well, the other thing that I would then say to them is there's an election coming up next May. You need to talk to the other parties on the council. It looks like the Greens are going to be the largest party after the election next May. What's your position on this? Because one of the things, as I was saying to the people from Acorn about the change in council tax arrangements, because there's an election coming up next May, the Greens are hoping to take over the council here. They can pick these causes up and say, right, well, we're going to, if the Labour mayor gets rid of the Cumber Centre and brings, gets rid of council tax.
Well, I think the idea is he's going to carry on, but with people appointed by the council, even though actually the whole thing is being run on a self-sufficient basis by the local
community
at the moment.
Well, if the council are funding it, and I used to work in the community section of the council, then they're in a position to say, well, we're not happy with the way you're running it. But if they're not funding it, they're not really in a position to say that, are they?
Well, they are, because it's council property, apparently.
Well, in that case, what you have to say is, either if they get kicked out, they could find some other property. But in actual fact, what they should argue is this is going to be a political issue coming up to the next election in May in Bristol, and political parties are going to have to decide whether we're going to be allowed to run it or not.
What?
And the Greens could easily say, I imagine it's probably Labour councillors here. The Greens could say, if you vote for
it's both Green and
okay.
And
well, it's obviously
Labour.
The Green councillor, whoever it may be, can say, well, if you vote for me or vote for my colleague, then we will keep this centre open and we will allow you to carry on running it. That's the way it's supposed to work, and that's what you know. And of course, because the election's coming up quite soon, that is the way to do it.
It's an important space. It's been there since the 1970s, apparently.
Well, exactly.
And it was put together on the back of Labour government in the 70s and the St Paul's riots in the 80s.
Yes. Okay, so it's got a long history, and obviously, if the council isn't funding the activities, then it's rather,
Well, it was funding Malcolm X, and it was funding the carnival. So it's taken a little while longer for them to chug down the line and say, well, although we're not funding you, we still want to control you because we own the building.
Yeah, okay. So, but I think the answer to that is, as I say, politics. Talk to your local Green councillor if the Labour Party don't want to talk to you and see what they say.
That came out of that meeting was a lot of annoyance and, to be fair, anger with the council for refusing to meet with them to discuss it.
Well, that also just suggests high-handed attitude, doesn't it? So, let's try and be as objective as possible about this. If the council have got a case, they ought to make it. If they're just acting without any discussion and claiming that they've got the power to do it, well, the answer to that is maybe you're not going to be in power come next May.
Yes, exactly. Good point. And this has been, we were talking about Monkton Wild last week, weren't we? There's an attempted coup there. We've got this, what I call an attempted coup down at Cumber, trying to kick the people who are running it out, even though you can't say they're not running it well, they are. They could say that, but they don't even bother saying that.
Well, it doesn't really matter if they've not been funded by the council. It's not a matter for the council how they run it.
Well, the council have managed to find some sort of, they think that there's a clause in the agreement that said that they weren't allowed to do what they did back in 2017, but they did clear it with the council at the time. So they said, well, this is all happening. Is that okay? Yes. And they just changed the people that the council or the company, the ownership of the people that were running it, because the previous lot disappeared and the new lot turned up. And that was all cleared with the council at the time, but now the council's changed their mind effectively. They don't want these new people to run it. But the point is, there are these coups going on. And another coup is one of the most shocking that I've seen anywhere in the UK. If you know of any, please do tell me, and we'll cover them, absolutely cover them. You know, and we're seeing community coups going on with, you could call them high-handed banksters or whatever, people with money and lawyers that just don't like the fact that there's independent little groups out there. Is this thing called the Countryside Restoration Trust, which was set up by a lovely guy called Robin Page, who wrote a book which I read called The Death of the English Village, or The Decline of the English Village, something like that, which looked at the way that English villages had declined after the Second World War, the various attributes that they had that were going. I mean, we're talking about, a lot of it is... developers coming in, even if it's councils building loads of council houses, changing the characters of the villages, and also getting rid of some of the traditional ways of farming, which meant that things like basic local shops, I suppose it's also transport, the buses, the cars, meant that they didn't have to have a local baker in the village. The bakers closed, sometimes the pub closed, this sort of thing. Anyway, Robin did a fantastic job of cataloguing all that. And his charity, the Countryside Restoration Trust, garnered, I think it was something like 12 or 15 different farms that people had given to him in their legacies. And then guess what? He gets a coup against him. People he thought were his friends, the trustees he'd appointed to help run the trust with him, turned on him and booted him out. But anyway, before they did that, one of the last speeches he gave, here is Robin Page talking about his vision for the countryside at one of their last AGMs that he was allowed to speak at before he died earlier this year.
I can see a lot of you are very young, and you might not have remembered 62, 63, because it meant that animals and birds that had DDT in their blood systems and in their bodies, they then had a period of very, very cold weather. They couldn't face it and they died. And a lot of our wildlife disappeared. Barn owls, kestrels, the hare, orchids, otters, a lot of things just vanished. And then over the years we thought, how can we bring this back? How can we hear skylarks sing again? And Gordon Benningfield and I, we went to the RSPB and we said to them, shouldn't you be doing something with farmland? Shouldn't you buy farmland and instead of telling farmers what to do, show farmers what to do? And they said, the director at the time was a chap called Ian Prest, and he said, the future is nature reserves. And so quite simply, we went back and said, well, we don't want the RSPB's future. The whole of the countryside is precious. Why do we want a few special areas? We want the whole place to be special. And so we started the Countryside Restoration Trust.
Which, well, it conked out last year, I think it was, 2022 or 21. The new trustees, who were led by the husband of the lady, just remind me of her name, Martin, who plays the MI5 boss in the Bond novels. Oh, gosh, what's her name? The actress. Huh? Judy Dench's husband, thanks Dave. So he then turned on Robin and said, well, we don't want you anymore, we're going to vote you off the board. And they voted him off the board and they took his trust off of him. And that was, well, in the region of about £50 million worth of donated land and farms. And then they changed the name of it to the Countryside, I think, is it Regeneration Trust rather than Restoration Trust. Now, the idea of Robin was that, no, nature reserves aren't needed. What we need is basically to get the mainly pesticides and fertilizers out of farming, which had arrived around about the time of the Second World War and after, had completely, none of which were good for wildlife, none of which were good for the ground. So he's saying, yeah, we can still farm without these kind of inputs, and yet that's that whole vision for his which various people have put their farms into his trust. Now, the trustees really are not trustworthy, are they? They've just completely got rid of the person that founded it, who's now dead, and it may have contributed to his death, having that absolute... When I spoke to him last year before he died, Robin sounded absolutely broken, like a broken man, you know, almost shaking as I spoke to him on the phone, as his whole life's work had been stolen from him.
Well, when you said earlier that he was against nature reserves, I don't think I didn't get that from what he was saying.
No, he's saying
we don't want to just do nature reserves.
Well, what he's saying is we want to do stuff on top of that as well. Well, the RSPB was saying is that we don't need so much farming. What we should be doing is turning this land over to nature reserves. He was saying, yes, we do need farming, and it just needs to, what we need to do is get rid of a lot of these chemicals that are being used on farms, which are affecting the wildlife.
Yeah, well, I mean, that doesn't mean you can't have nature reserves as well, but that the, obviously the main point is the actual farming, which is actually far, you know, bigger than nature reserves, has got to be ecological as well.
His point is that rather than donate, if people wanted to donate their land into a trust when they die, farmers or anybody, any landowner, can donate it to become a working farm rather than just a nature reserve.
That's right. So in other words, it's got a niche, it's got a niche appeal, hasn't it? And of course, what he's suggesting there is if we run these farms in an ecologically sound fashion, we're then setting an example to other farmers who can see that it's feasible and so on and so forth. And it's obviously, it's a, you know, things like this are not like top down government initiatives. It's a bottom up, let's try and, you know, pioneer some different ways of doing things so that we can give people an idea of the direction that we'd like to go in. But of course, all of these, any organisation, whatever its internal rules or whatever, there is going to be struggles about who controls it, what the direction is. Mm. So we're talking about the Labour Party earlier. Well, there it is. It's a classic. There's been the history of the Labour Party is a history of struggles to control its direction, to kick people in, to bring them out, you know, and kick people out to bring them in or whatever. And that's just one example. This is politics. I mean, politics involves this kind of stuff.
Well, it certainly does. And control of the land seems to be very high up on the agenda at the moment. It was nice to see the Right to Roam people doing a protest up in near Richmond in North Yorkshire for about the Right to Roam last weekend. That sort of thing's continually going on. But what we're seeing now, Martin, is this attempt by private equity firms and banks to take over land, isn't it? So as people are having trouble paying their mortgages, as interest rates go up, this sort of thing, rather than, say, the state taking over these properties and renting them back to them, what's happening is private companies are becoming some massive landowners. They're doing the same in the countryside. As we were hearing from Robert Kennedy a couple of weeks ago, they're basically coming along as cash buyers to buy this land up and buy this property up because they are cash rich, whereas the government and ordinary people are cash poor.
Well, that's right. It's the, you know, the privileges of the oligarchy, isn't it? I mean, what's happened in the Ukraine is that a lot of the land has been taken over by big Western companies like BlackRock and Vanguard, and it's them that are agitating for the Ukrainian grain to be allowed to be sold in Poland, Hungary, and Slovakia, because they're losing money because they can't export it through the Black Sea to places like Spain. Because most of Ukrainian grain did not go to Africa. That's ridiculous. So, the control of the land has always been fundamental in any society. I mean, that's what the communist revolution in China was all about. Land reform, which is why in Brazil there's never been a land reform, which is why you want one of the most unequal societies in the world.
This all boils down to communism, doesn't it, really?
Well, not communism, land reform.
Socialism?
No, land reform. At one stage, at the end of World War II, the United States itself decided that they were going to be in favour of land reform. So the guy who was in charge of their policy was a guy called Wolf Ladyinsky, who was actually a Ukrainian aristocrat family that emigrated to the US. And he said, if we're going to stop communism, what we've got to do is redistribute land from the big landowners to, small farmers. And that was actually part of US policy. And it was imposed, in fact, in Japan. The big landowners in Japan were, the land was taken off and given to the small farmers. And the same thing happened in South Korea, where the anti-communist government in South Korea did exactly the same thing in order to try and undermine the appeal of the communists, because the communist policy had always been land to the tiller. You know, those who work the land should own it.
This is an ongoing thing, isn't it?
And it's a fundamental struggle that's been going on for a long time.
And that long, that 370 years or something here in the UK ago, we had something called the English Civil War. And it's a little bit of I was a little bit disappointed that Ken Loach didn't really, he seemed to make out that it was the people that decided to chop off the head of Charles I. Of course, it wasn't. It was Parliament after Pride's Purge, after Cromwell's army had come into Parliament and got rid of all the MPs that might vote against the execution of, or the trial of Charles I. And, let's have a listen now to this excellent programme with Ken Loach, our local Chippenham film director, who won the palmed or at Cannes twice. I was reminded on this programme, I put a full version of this up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. It came out on the BBC Radio 4 this Tuesday. But here's a little insight into this movement that took place during the English Civil War, just at the end of it, really, after the execution of Charles I. The people said, well, look, now the king's gone, we want the land, and we think it's a good idea to redistribute it right across the world.
The idea of common ownership and equality goes back a long way. And in a way, Win Stanley was echoing John Bull from the Peasants' Revolt of 1381. And when Adam delved and Eve Spann, who was then the gentleman. Can I just read this quote from Win Stanley? In the beginning of time, the great creator made the earth to be a common treasury to preserve beasts, birds, fishes and man. Not one word was spoken in the beginning that one branch of mankind should rule over another. And it is that sense that class division is made by man. It's not inherent.
He wanted to get rid of buying and selling as well, didn't he, Anne?
Oh, yes. He says the cheating art of buying and selling. In his autobiographical passages, he said, you know, he'd been a freeman of London with a good business, but the cheating art of buying and selling had, plus the demands of war, had caused his bankruptcy. I mean, he was a buyer and seller, inevitably, in the world he had to live in, but he was against it, and he, in 1652, he published The Law of Freedom in a platform, which was a sort of general program for a sort of collective egalitarian society where people worked at their particular labours, but there was a common storehouse in each community, and you just went and, you know, if you needed clothes or food or whatever, you just went and got what you needed.
I think there's obviously a utopian sense, and particularly when you're trying to invent a constitution for a revolution that hasn't happened, that it can become fanciful to me. So I think, you know, I'd part company with him at that point. Mm. But I think the essence is, the essence of what he's saying has lasted.
We've been talking about his words and his writing, Anne, but he wanted to be a man of action and was.
Yes, he said, my mind was not at rest because nothing was acted and thoughts ran in me that words and writings were all nothing and must die. For action is the life of all, and if thou dost not act, thou dost nothing. So probably on April the 1st, 1649, when Stanley with others, as he says, took my spade and went and broke the ground upon George Hill in Surrey. As we know now, it's a gated estate, St George's Hill in Surrey. And it's interesting that they're claiming the common lands for their own as an example of what collective working of the land can do. They're not invading, you know, private property. They're trying to start with the common lands that belong to the commoners. Mm. So a group begins in Walton-on-Thames in April 1649.
I think it's important to say that it had two functions. It was, on the one hand, it was needed for hunger. They needed to plant for hunger, as we said. But also it was a symbol that the land belonged to the people. So it had two functions.
Well, great lives. Gerard Win Stanley, chosen by Ken Loach this week on BBC Radio 4, presented by Matthew Paris there, also with Anne Hughes, Emeritus Professor of something or other, early modern history, there we go, at Keele University. Martin, it's some people say, and they do mention this in the programme, that Gerard Win Stanley and the diggers were the first communists.
That's certainly the view of Christopher Hill, the Master of Balliol College, who wrote the book The World Turned Upside Down about the radicals in the English Revolution, as he called it.
Well, the Civil War, but look,
that's what he called it.
This is the, well, it wasn't really.
Well, he called it the English Revolution. Okay, fine, that's just
fine.
A fact.
Yes, I know, but it wasn't. You know, so I'm saying, and that's a fact, because all that was happened is it was replaced by another tyranny, which was basically a military dictatorship under Cromwell. But look, the point here is that a lot of this history was only really dug out, wasn't it, by historians after World War II? It was really.
Yeah, I mean, Christopher Hill was very important in bringing Winston Stanley back into mainstream historical analysis.
Had he ever been in mainstream
history? Well, no, the documents about his life had always been there, and he'd been a kind of footnote in most histories of the period. But the Marxist historians around Christopher Hill, people like E.P. Thompson and the guy who wrote the book about the Levellers, F.N. Brailsford, they were all influenced by communist ideas. I mean, they were members of the Communist Party. Many of them left in 1956 after the invasion of Hungary, but they were communists. And
the ones that stayed were called the tankies.
Well, that's right. Yes, I mean, that's a diversion.
I know, it is a bit, but you know.
But I mean, the point about it being that they were definitely looking for things in English history in particular, which were precursors of their own modern communist beliefs. And so they picked on Stanley and said, yes, this is clearly the beginning of the idea of communism and socialism. And I think there's a lot to be said for that, because it clearly was one of the, you know, it was a beginning of the modern movement for socialisation of the means
of
production.
Well, I'm sure Ken Loach was very familiar with Kevin Brownlow, who was another film director in the 1960s and 70s. Kevin Brownlow did a film called Win Stanley, which is a terrific black and white reenactment of the whole episode during the English Civil War. They couldn't get finance for it from the banks, funnily enough, so they just made it with a whole bunch of actors and managed to pay the actors a bit on the receipts that they got for the film. He also did another film called It Happened Here. I don't know if you ever saw that one, Martin, which was about the Nazi occupation of London, which was pretty shocking. I think that came out in the 1970s.
Yeah, I haven't. I think I've seen clips from This Happened Here, and I've seen the Win Stanley film years ago. I mean, again, this is as a result of the interests that modern people have taken in this era. For many, you know, in the 18th century or whatever, and after the restoration of King Charles II or whatever, I mean, the radical history of the English Civil War was suppressed. I mean, most people were openly loyal to the new regime because it was quite dangerous not to be. And so all of the radical...
Which new regime are you talking about?
Because we're talking about Charles II.
Yeah, what about the military dictatorship under
Cromwell?
Yeah,
but military dictatorship under Cromwell.
Those were the people that put down Win Stanley.
Yes, they did. And there was lots of things wrong that they did. I'm not trying to defend them.
So it was
them.
A ping pong.
I'm not trying to defend them, but once the monarchy had been restored, Britain, England, because of course there wasn't such a thing as Britain at that stage, England, politics and society moved radically to the right, so that they rejected Cromwell and everything he stood for. And they
certainly... How can you go to the right of Cromwell?
Cromwell has actually, listen, Tony, Cromwell has actually got quite an important part in it. This is the argument of the Marxists, that this was a revolution by the bourgeoisie against the aristocracy. It wasn't a revolution by the ordinary folk, that's to come.
No.
The proletarian revolution
This is
the teleology.
Fingers crossed.
This is the teleology of the communist ideology, if you like. But, the whole idea of when Christopher Hill's called the English revolution a revolution, he said it broke the back of the traditional aristocracy in the country and opened the way to capitalism. That's what we want. That's what's supposed to happen. That's all in the Communist Manifesto. Capitalism is necessary before you can have socialism.
The feudal classes
makes it scientific.
The feudal classes were broken to be replaced by the merchant classes, who then got on with creating a British Empire getting everybody off the land, putting them into factories, and building a navy and an army.
From a Marxist point of view, all of that stuff is inevitable, and what the revolution comes at the end of all of that. If you're a utopian socialist, as they would say,
so is the takeover of AI inevitable? To extend it on.
No,
to
I'm
now?
Just saying. Listen, yes, but the AI didn't exist in the 1950s.
Sure any of these things are inevitable.
No, well, I'm just saying in the communist ideology. I'm just describing the ideology. I'm not saying that they are inevitable. I'm just describing the way it operates or fits together according to those who believe in it. And of course, the whole idea of Marxism was that there had been socialistic ideas before about sharing things and so on, but it was based upon an unproductive agricultural society where there wasn't that much to share at the end of the day.
Well, actually,
therefore, capitalism, let's just finish the point.
Yeah, okay.
Capitalism develops the productive forces to the point where you can think about everybody having a sufficiency without exploitation.
Or
and
you
so
can
on.
Think about having an empire.
Well, you can have both. the empire is all part part of the expansion of capitalism. They're looking for markets and raw materials and so on. All of which is in the teleology of communism, which is almost derived indirectly, if you like, from the Christian story of salvationism, that at the end of history there is going to be a second coming, there are going to be a better world, because we'll have solved lots of technical problems.
In the meantime,
problems.
It's going to be pretty rough.
Well, in the meantime, it's class struggle, which is as Mao Zedong said, class struggle is not a Sunday afternoon tea party, it's an act of violence by which one class destroys another or overthrows another.
Well, don't the upper classes know that, and aren't they going to destroy the lower classes before
they? And that's
why
you've got to have something like the People's Liberation Army to smash them, Tony.
Who?
The People's Liberation Army of China.
So you're looking forward to them coming?
No, I'm just pointing out this is the communist ideology.
So, so are they going to come over to Europe?
No, what they're doing at the moment is they've carried out a land reform in China, which ultimately was quite successful. They've created what they call socialism with Chinese characteristics, and they are at the moment playing a game of chess with the Western powers to take over the developing world. And the West is going to be kicked out of West Africa, for example. And who's going to take over? The Chinese.
Well, Europe is going to be kicked out of West Africa, which is no bad thing, is it?
Well, there you are. This struggle is going on as predicted in the Communist Manifesto of 1848. It's all there. It's exactly what's happening. Marx and Engels weren't stupid. They didn't understand everything, and a lot of it was very kind of vague and not very helpful. But the fact is, most of what they were saying has come to pass in the way that they suggested it would.
Well, they were big over in Yugoslavia, where I've been the last little while, and. But anyway, what about the migrant crisis? How does that fit into this Marxist idea? Because it's seen as a crisis. Is it really a crisis or not? Having loads of new people coming into the UK, a lot of people would argue with it and say, well, actually, this is no good thing for British culture at all.
Well, hang on. The migrant crisis doesn't just affect the UK, Tony. I mean, Suella Braverman went to America this week to speak at the American Enterprise Institute. She spoke for half an hour, and she said there are 750 million migrants in the world today. A tiny, tiny fraction of them come to Britain. Britain is a tiny country, and only a tiny fraction of the global migrant crisis is affecting us.
She said something. I think she said something along the lines of, "There are 750 million people who could potentially claim asylum in Britain."
Well, that may be so, but potentially, but they can't, because most of them are actually displaced within their own countries. There are 7 million people in Colombia who've been driven off the land by right-wing paramilitaries during the war there, and they live in slums around the big cities. But they are refugees.
Anyway,
and if you cross a border, you become an international refugee, and most international refugees have crossed just one border to the nearest country. So loads of people from Somalia have ended up in Kenya.
Not true.
I think it is, Tony.
No, it isn't.
Most people who are refugees have crossed just one border to the nearest country. Everybody looking at this from a British point of view.
What about Europe and the US?
Europe and the US are bigger, and there are more refugees.
Don't have many refugees.
No, the
in
biggest
Europe
number
the
of refugees are in war zones in the developing world. They always have been.
They're not economic migrants, then.
If you get driven out of your country by war, you're not an economic migrant. Yeah. You're running away from being killed.
What I'm talking about is economic migrants.
Well, who's an economic? I'll tell you who is an economic migrant. Suella Braverman, who came here in the 1960s from Tanzania to get a better life. She's definitely an economic
migrant. Get on to this interesting documentary which has come out in the last couple of weeks called A London Lost, The Death of an English City, which looks at the mass migration into the UK over the last 40, 50 years.
If there is a date when the demographic transformation of London, and indeed Britain, took on a whole new order, it would be 1997 and the election of the Blair government. From that point on, migration on a scale which could be argued as reasonable enough in any country gradually gave way to the imposition of a mass migration which was without historical precedent. All of this has meant that a new narrative has had to be put in place and pushed at any opportunity. London, it is claimed, is and always has been a city of immigrants. Just last month, Mayor Sadiq Khan proclaimed that London was in fact built by migrants and refugees.
Well, I mean, quite simply, the idea that London has always been a multicultural city and that it's thanks to immigrants that this wonderful megapolis was built is, quite frankly, is propaganda. It's propaganda that's not based in any fact. It's a myth, of course.
Poppycock. It's absolute nonsense. And then I speak as a Windrush generation migrant. I came here in 1956 and my father came here in 1950 and we were part of that early post-war generation of migrant coming here. Well, frankly, the sort of people that Sadiq Khan is talking about came much later. In 1954, I think there was only something like 4% of the population was, in fact, non-UK-born, shall we say.
Apart from being historically nonsensical, Sadiq Khan's claims amount to a gross insult to the countless generations of English and British Londoners who, over centuries, made their city one of the greatest in the world. It's the kind of revision of history which Orwell spoke about. Woe betide anyone who goes against it. The comedian John Cleese was condemned simply for saying that London was no longer really an English city, something which to most sentient people would be a perfectly reasonable view. Indeed, the boosters and promoters of contemporary London actually glory in the fact that it is not English or British. To them, that's a virtue. It's what makes the city great.
It's only been recently in the post-war years that we've seen this change, but as recently as 1961, almost 98%, 97.7% of London was white. By 1971, when you begin to see the end of empire and people coming here, then you begin to see a drop. So it was 93% in 1971. By 1981, that had dropped down to 86%. And then by 1991, it had gone down to 80%. And that's when you see the great dramatic drop happening on. Because between 1901 and 2001, of course, we had Tony Blair starting, and we saw a 20% drop in London's white population from 80% down to 60%. Then by 2011, it had gone down to around 45%. And at the last census in 2021, we know that the population of London that is white British is about 37%. So it's quite without precedent, I think, in the history of the modern world, for a city, a capital city, to have its indigenous population decline from 97%, 98% in 1961, down to the fact that it's barely a third 70 years later.
So that's a London lost. A London lost, the death of an English city, Martin. This is a massive change, isn't it, from 98% we were hearing back in the 1950s and 60s, right the way down to now 36% are actually white British in London.
Well, the success of London as a city from the late Middle Ages onwards has always depended on people coming in from outside. So the medieval city, most people who lived in London had come from outside because the death rate was so enormous. People died off huge amounts, so people had to be replaced by people coming in when London was the biggest city in the world, mostly from other parts of the UK, although there wasn't a UK in those days. It was quite British, but there's a big, very big Irish population, for example, in London, and certainly all the other major cities like Liverpool and Glasgow. And that was in the 19th century. And the other point I would make is this. The success of the city of London depended upon what you were talking about earlier, Tony, the empire. The empire of which it controlled India and the West Indies, which were the most profitable parts of the empire. And that's where all the money came from to pay for the development of London and what made London what it was.
Isn't the reason that these people have been encouraged in, and more recently, you know, we were up to something like 350,000 a year coming into the UK, simply to undermine trade unions, to undermine wages as cheap labour? I mean, that's surely what it's all about. And of course, to them, it's not cheap. To a lot of the people coming into the country, they're able to send money back to their family and maybe even stay here permanently, and they see it as a very rich country that they're able to make, you know, maybe 10-20 times more than they would be able to in the country of origin.
Well, a lot of the immigration into Britain after 1997, and they talked about Tony Blair there, is because the British government pushed for a rapid expansion of the EU, and therefore allowing people from the EU, including from Eastern Europe, to come to Britain, the Polish plumber being, you know, the classic example of that. And, of course, they're not black, but they're not English. In any case, the cities change. The major cities in the United States of America have always been full of immigrants because every white person in America or Australia or Canada or New Zealand is in fact descended from immigrants. And what happened in the 19th century is as we were getting overpopulation in Britain, we transported a lot of our poor people to Australia to take the land from the local people. And this is actually the history of our country.
Yeah, but in a way,
the history of our country is global. It's been global for hundreds of years.
What you're saying in a way is it's payback time.
It's not payback time, but most of the people who came in here came in after the war because there was actually a labour shortage when Enoch Powell was Transport Minister in the Conservative government.
Well, it's very different. We're not really talking about that. It's very now, isn't it?
Well, yes, and you can't just emigrate here from Jamaica. There are loads of people here who've got family in Jamaica and they cannot emigrate here because they're not allowed. On the other hand, it's much easier if you are from New Zealand or Australia to get a place
in
Britain.
It's not really about whether it's allowed, is it? Because what's happening is lots of people are arriving. In that they are not supposedly not allowed, but yet they're staying.
Well, they are allowed because they're asylum seekers, and we've actually destroyed Afghanistan, Libya, Iraq, and Syria. And these are all countries, especially Libya and Syria, not that far away, much nearer to us than the United States of America.
Have we destroyed Albania?
Yes, we did, because in the 1990s and onwards, we imposed a Thatcherite policy on them to privatise everything, drive everybody off the land, hand it over to foreign multinationals. The mafia in Italy took over Albania with the full support of NATO. And, of course, Yugoslavia, there were loads and loads of refugees from there because Yugoslavia was destroyed by NATO. That means by Britain. Okay. Now, in actual fact, you can't stop these people coming on the rubber dinghies, as Sir Braverman has found out. They're going to come because of the crisis in the global situation. We've got 3 million Ukrainians in Britain. 3 million since the start of the war. They've all arrived. Are they going to stay? I think they are going to stay, Tony, because they're not going back to Ukraine, which is now a basket case. But we created the war in the Ukraine. It was NATO special forces who shot down the people in the Maidan Square to carry out the coup.
What's the bigger plan to have all these migrants coming into the UK? Is it going to become the world's first really internationalist country?
No, it's not just the UK that's facing a migrant crisis, Tony. The world is facing one because we're in World War III. That's what we're facing. Since 9/11, we've been in World War III. And there are going to be more refugees.
Smugglers are weaponizing people.
Yes, they are. And the drug smugglers as well are making money out of chaos. And of course, so are the banks making money out of chaos. So are the arms companies making money out of chaos. And one of the things we could do if we wanted to, for example, to solve the problem of homelessness in Britain is we could confiscate all the wealthy people's houses, the Saudis, all these other people that are buying places in Britain, and they use those places and they bring money in, and therefore they can just walk into our country. Now, maybe we should just say, you can't come to our country. We don't care how much money you've got. We're going to keep our housing stock for our people and also for citizens of our country that we've accepted because they are genuine asylum seekers. No Saudi princes, definitely Somali people who are running from
persecution. None of this has got anything to do with the fact that Frontex, the European Border Control Agency, are actually in bed with the mafia, bringing people in.
No, Frontex, as you know, because we had, remember Kevin from Belfast talking about this when we used to be in the old building, in the City Academy. Frontex actually kills people, and they're under investigation for killing people to try and prevent them coming in. And there's actually been rows going on this week between the Italians, who say that they don't want people, you know, the refugees that are coming in have got to be redistributed around the system, and the others, Northern Europeans, the Germans and the Netherlands and so on, we're not in this discussion, of course, because we've left the EU now, and we've got nothing to say about it. Nobody's interested in our opinion.
But they weren't anyway.
No, but the point is, Tony, if you live in Greece, Spain or Italy, you really are being overwhelmed by people coming in, and there's nothing you can do about it. Now, if there's some solidarity, we all went to war together in Iraq, didn't we, apart from the Germans and the French who said they didn't want to. What the Germans and the French could say to the British is this: you wanted to go into war in Iraq, so all these people from Iraq who are claiming asylum you can have them, because we said we didn't want the war.
But it may be this is actually just...
Maybe what we should do is send them all to the United States of America, because they're the ones who started all the wars.
Well, it may be just that this is a policy of the European Union. Actually,
it's a policy of NATO, Tony.
And the European Union, and that's actually what they want, is this cheap labour. So let's have a listen now to...
You're obsessed with this cheap labour stuff. That's not. There's actually an argument against all of that, which is in A-level economics textbooks, and I haven't got the time to run through it.
Well, explain. Why is this cheap labour not happening?
It is happening. What's happening about cheap labour is to do with slashing trade unions.
Loads of people are being made unemployed, and what's happening is...
There's not a big unemployment in this country. At the moment, we've got people working very hard for rubbish money. That's what's happening. We will have unemployment.
But it's driving down wages. That's what I said, cheap labour. Don't you know what cheap labour means?
Listen, Tony, there are economic arguments for having migration, because what migration shows is your economy's growing. And as your economy grows, you've got more money to spend on things. What's happened as a result of Brexit is that skilled labour from the European Union can't come to Britain, and that's forcing up inflation, which means we've got to raise interest rates, which means that the economy goes down the drain.
I think you know the low wages in Britain mean that loads of skilled people are just going abroad.
No, that's not...
They are. I mean, this is one of the reasons there's an NHS strike. That's one of the reasons that there's a public sector strike.
Well, the NHS is a very interesting case.
Let me finish the sentence. One of the reasons why the doctors have been on strike, the junior doctors, etc., is because they're seeing all their colleagues go abroad because the wages are so low.
And most of the people working in the NHS, as you probably well know, Tony, come from abroad. And in actual fact, they've had to change the rules so that people can come here to work, because there's an idea...
They don't want to, because wages have...
Yeah, well, that's right, so we need to raise the wages, and that...
Wages have
been
driven...
Yes, and that means we will attract doctors from the rest of the world.
Wages have been driven down so far.
That's right.
Anyway, let's have a listen now to...
By smashing trade unions and the policy of various Tory governments.
Well, that as well.
Yeah.
But also, you know, that would never have worked if you haven't got this massive pool of cheap labour.
Yeah, the massive pool of cheap labour is what keeps the NHS going, Tony. Without it, it would collapse.
Well, maybe.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
What they've done by doing that, of course, is kick the can down the road. Anyway, let's have a listen now to Dr. Matthias Ruth. It was Jungle Bus Millie that introduced me to him. He's a German doctor that thinks that the big cartels are just simply running the European Union, and always have been.
Walter Hallstein and his speech in 1939. So 6 months before they invaded Poland, this guy publicly tells everyone how the future will look, which laws they will impose in Poland. The new laws, economic laws, social laws, administrative laws, patent laws, and as you've heard, the blood and honor laws. So it was all planned. One of the central elements of their strategy was the so-called Grand Plan East, in German Generalplan Ost. It was very simple. Germany was the cartel's economic and political headquarters. And Eastern Europe and the rest of the world was a reservoir of dependent consumers and slave laborers. That was the plan. Auschwitz. No coincidence. A concentration camp 7 kilometers from the largest IG Farben factory at that time. They expanded the concentration camp Auschwitz as a reservoir for the slave labor they needed to build these industrial plants. IG Auschwitz was a 100% subsidiary of IG Farben. We are told the medical experiments conducted on thousands of innocent inmates of the concentration camps were the criminal acts of deviated SS doctors. The Nuremberg war crime tribunal records tell us something completely different. This picture is one of the pictures from that trial. It shows ampules injected into concentration camp inmates. And the preparation says what? Bayer. IG Farben Industries. The preparation didn't have a name. It was a code name because it was what? Patented. So these companies, they used the concentration camps as huge human laboratories to test their patented chemicals. In many cases, with deadly results. And who owned the patents of the drugs tested? This one here, from December 13, 1934, Bayer. What was the substance tested? It was an azo compound. What is an azo compound? You don't need to be a chemist. Look at those two balls, nitrogen and nitrogen. Remember the Lego principle? Cyclone B used to kill millions in the Katzet gas chambers. Who was supplied by the IG Farben subsidiary Degish? After World War II, Degish executive Carl Wuster became head of the new BASF. He didn't end up in prison for what he did. He was made captain of one of the flagships of post-war chemical BASF. Again, from the Nuremberg War Crimes Tribunal's documents, the dependency of the Nazi Wehrmacht on IG Farben's products. 100% of the rubber used by the Wehrmacht came from IG Farben. 100% of the oil used. 100% of the blood syrup, and so on and so forth. Any questions? We can summarize that chapter of history, especially of Polish history, as follows. World War II was the second attempt of the chemical drug cartel at the military conquest of the world to create a one single planet-wide market. More than 60 million soldiers and civilians from more than 50 countries died in the cartel's second attempt at this conquest. And again, the knowledge, the analysis that you hear tonight from us was unfortunately not available at that time. So mankind had to go through this experience. There was a trial, as we heard. 24 executives of IG Farben were tried in Nuremberg for crimes against humanity. We saw Fritz Demir sentenced for genocide, slavery, plundering and other war crimes. Imagine the head of Bayer, at that time the largest pharmaceutical company in the world, a company parading as the savior of mankind with new medicines, making billions with that image, and is hit sentenced for mass murder.
I'm trying to work out what exactly is being said there. We know that the big industry in Germany was part of the Nazi infrastructure. He told us the basic stuff about that. And we know that. And you know, it was all terrible, and obviously, you know, something, there was never real accounting for that and all the rest of it, but I failed to see where you're going with it, or where he's going with it.
Where he's going with it is that the whole thing of the European Union is just a progression from these cartels, that the big corporations are running things still, and appointing the people that they want to be the European commissioners, that the whole thing of electing your MPs to the European Parliament is completely ineffective and a farce, and they have got no real power. He's saying that now this is basically a cartel-run continent.
Yes, and the German industrial cartels have just been smashed by NATO, by the Americans and by the British,
who blew up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. The cartels have not been smashed at all.
Yes, they have.
No,
they're not going to. The industry in Germany is moving either to China or the United States. They're going being deindustrialized. So if it was a Nazi German plot to take over the EU, the EU is being smashed as we speak by the Anglo-Americans. We are the junior partners with the Americans in smashing the EU. And therefore,
so is Germany finished as an industrial power?
Absolutely. And it's going to, and of course, when the Germany.
Why is that then?
Because the Americans don't want them as a threat. The idea, if the Germans got together with the Chinese and the Russians, which is absolutely logical, then the Americans are no longer to be number one on the planet.
That's and never going to happen. Surely that's never going to happen. We've just had the Nord Stream pipeline blown up by the Americans, and the Germans haven't even said a word.
That's because they're under the thumb, Tony. So they're definitely not running things. These German cartels, IG Farben and so on.
I'm not just talking about German cartels. The cartels are not interested in individual nations, are they?
No.
This is global capitalism.
No, well, global capitalism is run from the United States with Britain as a subsidiary. That's the rules. And therefore, any other, what's happening in Eastern Europe is that Europe is being smashed economically by the United States. Russia isn't being smashed. Russia's doing rather well. The real problem is going to be in the poorer European countries, like Britain, because once the interest rates really start to bite in this country, we are going to have mass unemployment, and it's going to be there for a generation. And, of course, we've already got loads of social problems, and it's going to become more and more like a United States big city.
Are they going to be blaming all this on the Russians, do you think, at the time?
Well, at the moment, that's the way they're trying to spin it, is that the Russians did all of this. But since it's obvious that the Nord Stream pipeline was not blown up by the Russians, it should also be obvious that it's not the Russians who are deindustrializing Western Europe. It's not in their interests. The Russians were supplying cheap gas to the Germans to create a dependency so that we could all work together
We hear that the Russian economy this week has been doing extremely well. It's now bounced back way above the pre-COVID levels, despite these
unlike
so-called
the British economy.
Yes, well, all the European economies. So what you say makes quite a lot of sense, that the Europe seems to be really suffering because of this rift with Russia.
Well, it's also, I mean, Michael Hudson is quite clear. The purpose of the sanctions on Russia isn't to crush Russia, it's to crush Germany. And if you remember, the justification of NATO by one of its founder members was to keep the Russians out, the Americans in, and the Germans down. And that's still what it's doing, isn't it? NATO, the EU is a busted flush because it's basically a condom for NATO. It's always been a condom for NATO. What we really need is a proper European Union where we've got socialist policies across the board from
Well, don't hold your breath.
Well, I'm not holding my breath, but Portugal and Spain have still got pretty decent left-wing governments because they've got a proportional system and they've got a history standing up for their own people.
Yeah, but Greece has as well. And look what happened to, is it Pegida over there? Completely
not
smashed.
Not Pegida, you mean Syriza. Pegida's a right-wing. Yes, it was completely smashed because Greece is a weak country. And therefore, weak, you know, what's it, this, the Thucydides or Thucydides said in the Peloponnesian War, the strong do what they will, and the weak must suffer what they must.
Actually,
one of Varoufakis' books is called exactly that.
The Poles have been doing reasonably well as well, haven't they?
The Poles are not doing very well. They're rowing
well,
with
they're
the
standing
Ukraine.
Up to the Ukrainians and the EU, aren't
well,
they?
No, but at the same time...
And NATO.
No, they haven't. What they've done is they've suddenly realised that they're in a car crash and they're trying to break. But they have actually been, I mean, it upsets me about Poland because they could have been players. When I used to work with them in the 1980s and into the 1990s, Poland's quite a big country with a big economy. They've got quite a big population, 70, 80 million people. They could have had an independent policy, independent
so
both of the West
who
and
has,
of the
who
Russians.
Who has undermined them?
They jumped into bed with NATO and the EU and all the rest of it, and then they were told to carry out a Thatcherite policy, the Balcerowicz plan. I was in Poland when it was brought in, and everybody was put out of work. The traditional way of doing things was smashed. Any kind of rational policy towards the economy was poo-pooed, and I was involved in discussions about what was to do with the Polish economy at the time with Marek Grzelczyk from Warsaw University, and they just did a Thatcherite policy, which actually led to a situation where all young people in Poland have to leave the country for work. And that's what used to be the case before the war. And it's certainly true of the Baltic states. There's hardly any young people left in the Baltic states because there's no work there. And that's because they've been deindustrialized by the West.
Now, you mentioned Michael Hudson. I'm glad you did, because there was a terrific discussion with two of our favourite people, him and Pepe Escobar, this week about what has been exactly the topic we're talking about, the effect of Ukraine on NATO and the BRICS countries economically.
You can see what the effect of the war is on the sanctions against Germany. What was happening before the war, before 2022, was Germany was supporting the euro's exchange rate. And it was German industrial exports. And what it was doing, it was producing these industrial goods by importing gas and energy from Europe. And it was paying for them by exporting automobiles and industrial products. So Germany and the EU balance of payments with Russia was essentially they weren't running a deficit. It was all in balance, and the euro was stabilized because there wasn't outward pressure. But now that the sanctions have become what you call the Ukraine war is really the U.S.-NATO war, the U.S. war against NATO to absorb it into the U.S. economy. So look at what's happening now. Not only is Europe being told to replenish all of the arms that have been destroyed, and that's about 2% of GDP, Europe will now have to spend about 3% of its GDP on replenishing the arms, not from Russia or China, but from the United States. That means that not only will the budget deficit not permit any more domestic spending to help pull Europe out of the depression, but it's going to be a balance of payments outflow to the United States, while Europe and especially Germany buy U.S. Gas and other as well as arms from the United States. Well, what this means is that there's no reciprocity there. The United States is not going to do what Russia did and turn around and buy German and other European industrial exports because the United States is protectionist. So it's going to be a one-way payment instead of a balanced trade from the euro to the United States. And I did an interview with a German press yesterday, and the belief now is that the euro is going to go down right through the dollar to 90 cents, maybe 85 cents in the next few years. Now, imagine what this is going to do. The euro's balance of payments deficit is going to raise prices, because prices are set internationally for all raw materials, for imports. It's going to make the cost of living higher, while the government, Baerbock, said she doesn't care what the voters say. She has to make the word safer democracy, which means autocracy and the old, pre-Orwellian doublespeak. This means there's already large-scale unemployment there, and where are the German? Germany's going to end up looking like Latvia and Estonia. Where are the German workers going to move? They can't move to the United States because that would be competing with American labor, and the United States has, set up its barriers. Is it going to move to Russia, China, Kazakhstan? Who knows what it's going to do? But this, the United States has lost Europe, and as you say, Asia's turned its back on Europe. Europe has nothing to offer except subservience to the United States. So you can just see that this whole part of the world that was the center has now fallen off the edge.
It's the contrast of. You're perfect diagnostic, Michael. You explained the European malaise in 5 minutes. And when you compare to what they are discussing in China, in Asia, in Southeast Asia, and in Vladivostok for that matter. For instance, there were panels in Vladivostok about relationship between BRICS and the Eurasian Economic Union. There's a more or less a consensus that sooner or later they have to get sit at the same table and start discussing, among others, a new payment, a settlement system. In one of the panels that I had the honor to be part with, there were only heavyweights, in fact, including one of the best Russian economists, Andrei Klepash. He works for VAB Bank. There was people from the Duma as well. Sergei Glazyev intervened online. His deputy, his number two, Dmitry Mityayev, was also part of the panel. And, of course, Klepash came up with a very wonderful definition. He says that a currency, by definition, has to be liquid and stable, like vodka. So at the moment, we're not there yet in terms of the new Eurasia currency, which is being debated, especially here. It's one of the key debates everywhere. But I have a question for both of you, because this question came up in Vladivostok, and it's a little bit of a rage here as well, which is involves the Bank of International Settlements and the IMF. Nothing can be done by the BRICS as long as the IMF continues to dictate, as Michael explains very well, all over the world, the terms of their collaboration with the Global South. And what the possibility, and considering the fact that all the central banks of the BRICS countries are part of the Bank of International Systems. So I know that you can explain this in one or two minutes, and I'm sure the audience will be very, very interested. And also an extra problem, the fact that the new development bank, the BRICS bank, basically, essentially, as Glazyev has been saying all the time, it's still dollarized. And how are they going to escape from the fact that they are dollarized? This is something that a question that I'd like to pose in China next month. But for the moment, the discussion here is raging about all this.
Sure. Did you want to go first, Michael, or shall I?
There's a real problem. And last time we talked, I said, well, before there's a formal currency, which needs governments all to get together, they're going to have to hold each other's currency for a while with currency swaps. But the Financial Times just had a very interesting article yesterday about Russian oil sales of oil to India. Russia's been selling its oil to Europe by way of India. And the Europeans pretend that this is not sanctioned oil because it's Indian oil from, as we all know, India's vast oil wells reserves. But it turns out that India pays Russia in its own currency that is unconvertible. They're blocked currency, just like the German blocked marks of the 1920s. The Indian rupees that it pays Russia can only be spent on imports from India. And this is not a free market in currency. This is not stable. What on earth is Russia going to do with all this huge mass of rupees that can only be spent on buying rupian exports? This is something that cannot last a long time. And the United States, recently in visiting India, has jumped on this and said, look, this is all going to end. You'd better throw in your lot with us and block the Belt and Road. Remember, you're fighting China up in near Tibet in the Himalayas. You really have to join NATO, basically. And so that is the subterranean, that's the pressure. And the United States, having mounted a coup in Pakistan last year, is saying the same thing to Pakistan. Don't let the Chinese pipeline go through Pakistan. What you want is for the oil to be from a port to a ship, to a railroad, to a port, to a ship, back to another railroad. I mean, this crazy line that the United States has tried to get to is an alternative to the Belt and Road. This is the issue that the United States is trying to do to interrupt this whole continuity And that's going to be the political fight that I think unfolds during the next 12 months.
Well, I mean, you could almost switch off everybody else and just get all your news from Michael Hudson, in a way, Martin, couldn't you? Because he's there, he's explaining a hell of a lot of geopolitics, the things that are going on behind the scenes, where actually a lot of this is just about commodities and money, and in the various powers are just manufacturing principles in order to justify what is actually a massive geopolitical battle about resources.
Well, he published the book Super Imperialism in 1972, and when he wrote it, he's got a leftist background. I mean, his family were Trotskyists, I believe, and Minneapolis at one stage had a Trotskyist council, would you believe, in the United States, and that's where he's from. He's from Minneapolis, and his father was part of that sort of scenario. But he wrote a book called Super Imperialism. It came out in 1972, and he thought, well, I've written this book now, and it'll affect my career in various ways. It's obviously a very critical book. But to his great surprise, he was approached by Herman Kahn from the Pentagon and said, we want you to come teach our generals everything that's in your book about how to rob the world, because the book was about how to rob the world. And so he then spent some time teaching at the US War College to all these generals about how to rob the world and how to do it properly. Although he did say to them at the time, don't forget, other people will know this. I'm telling you it. Everybody else is going to work it out as well. And then they're not going to, you know, they're going to react to this. And I think that, you know, the Western capitalist system has been the problem and still is the problem.
I mean, there's all sorts of interesting things he brings up there. So, for example, this idea of India is going to have to join NATO.
Well, India is a swing state. They went to South Africa to the BRICS conference. Modi was there, and he agreed that they would expand the BRICS to bring in some more countries. The Chinese wanted more, and the Indians wanted less, but they then settled for the ones that they were going to have in there. India is trying to be, I mean, what's happening in the developing world is that they can see that this big battle's developing between India, between China, Russia, the West, and the India as another player, and they're trying to maneuver themselves to get the best deal they can from all of them. I mean, that's what you do if you're a small African country. You go to the Americans and say, what have you got to offer us? And then you go to the Russians and say, well, what have you got to offer us?
I'd say the big battle is actually between China and the States. The Russians, I think the Americans and the NATO have made it clear that they don't want the Russians being hanging around in the background as a third force. So they're going to have to sort of get them out of the way somehow.
Well, I mean, they've miscalculated all of this completely. Yeah. They presumed that Russia was in the same kind of...
They're going to plough on regardless. You know, well, it doesn't matter if they've been miscalculated.
Well, they're going to plough on regardless, but also they're going to be defeated because it's not a viable strategy.
And it's almost like it doesn't matter if they're defeated. Listen, they've been... How many wars have the Americans started now where they've been defeated? Afghanistan, Iraq, I mean, Vietnam. Everything they do, they get defeated, but it doesn't stop them.
Well, it does at some point. I mean, the Roman Empire was unbeatable for many centuries.
I suppose they're saying, for example, this war that's going on in Ukraine, the only bad consequences of it, the Americans have calculated, are going to be for Europe. So why not just carry on?
Well, that's one of the reasons why they are carrying on. It's also inexplicable why people in, you know, political elites in the West, Western Europe in particular, have gone along with this. Only a couple of weeks ago, Boris Johnson was in Kiev getting an honorary degree from the university in Kiev, and we've got photographs of him making a Nazi salute along with everybody else in that meeting. And that's because the Western elites are absolutely in the pocket of the United States. Boris Johnson represents the United States. Rishi Sunak represents the United States.
Liz Truss represents
the United States. That's right.
Yes.
And that's the real lack of sovereignty in these benighted isles.
Quite right. Anyway, what do you make of this? I mean, he was talking about Vladivostok there, wasn't he? A very important meeting that took place.
Yeah, well, it's an annual meeting that they have in Vladivostok.
It's becoming more and more important, yeah, isn't it? And he's talking also about this whole idea of an Asian, is it a new Eurasian currency, which they're talking about. It's not actually going yet.
Well,
do you think it'll ever happen, that
sort
of thing?
Hudson's quite good on this, because what's happening in the alt media and in, you know, people who are against the Western powers, everybody's getting a bit carried away that there's going to be a collapse in the dollar and that there's going to be an alternative currency system. We're a long way from that. What's beginning to happen? What's it Churchill said after Alan?
You've changed your tune.
No, I haven't, Tony. Because I would like to see an alternative financial system. Of course I would, but you can't just magic it out
but
of thin air.
But it's going to be their alternative, surely.
There are things that can be done.
The central bank digital currencies are sitting waiting in the background.
Well, yes, but the central bank digital currency can be imposed by the Chinese for their own purposes or by somebody else for different purposes. A lot of the objection, as Hudson points out, to central bank digital currencies is from private bankers. Because once you've got a central bank digital currency, you don't need private banks at all. Just as they have in China, there are no private banks, effectively.
But aren't these central bank digital currencies going to be basically sold by... I mean, you know, you're going to have a central bank which is the regulator, but these private banks are all going to be dealing and trading in these central bank digital currencies. That's the whole idea of it.
Well,
you know, there'll be the retail arm of it, basically, and the people who decide how many of these various currencies are going to lend to who.
Well, the question is, which central bank's going to decide? Is it going to be the People's Bank of China or the Bank
of
International?
The cartel. Look, HSBC, Barclays, the rest of them aren't going away, are they?
But not in China.
No, over here.
The biggest banks in the world are all Chinese, and they're all owned by the Chinese government.
And the thing is, they've got a bit of a property collapse going on.
And they have indeed. So in other words, what may happen, of course, in The Economist and all the rest of it, they're rubbing their hands together. Oh, the Chinese have finally run out of road. And of course, this is what the COVID attack on China was all about. They're trying to cut the Chinese down to size before they get to the point where they can take off. Now, the Chinese are very well aware of that, and that's why we're going to have World War III, but the Russians are doing a very good job of doing the first bit. NATO is being absolutely smashed in the Ukraine. It's not just the Ukrainian army that's being smashed, it's NATO that's being smashed. And if the Russians smash NATO, then the Chinese don't have to worry about it. We're going to send our aircraft carrier. I'm sure Suella's in favour of that. Let's send our aircraft carrier to the South China Sea to be sunk by the Chinese silkworm missile with everybody on board.
Okay, so we've got the Conservative Party conference kicking off this weekend. Do you think they're going to be able to convince anybody to vote for them next year?
Well, obviously some people will vote for them, whatever. Political parties
but
of
the
that
polls,
size.
They're in the polls. You've seen the polls, I'm
yes,
sure.
Yes, I know, but they're still...
They're going to lose.
They're going to lose the election.
And there may well be a hung parliament, but they're certainly not going to win, are they?
No, I think it's unlikely. You know, Ladbrokes don't think they're going to win. I hope they don't. But they obviously,
but
they want
it,
to, and they're trying to find a way to do it.
My question is it feasible? I mean, we'll be asking the same question next week about the Labour conference, but is it feasible that the Tories might be able to... there seems to be a kind of scrabbling, doesn't there, at the moment, to reverse many of these net zero policies by Sunak in order to make sure that he doesn't lose too many votes because of people being... I mean, for example, they're now talking about limiting local authorities' powers to impose these clean air zones after all these clean air zones have been imposed. And it's also worth pointing out there was a fascinating article in the Daily Express, which shows just how low down on the scale of countries which are causing emissions that Britain is. I mean, it's pretty shocking, really, to see. The UK is nowhere to be seen on the list of the world's worst countries for carbon emissions. So it's a bit of a no-brainer. They're also talking, I was watching Question Time last night, about cancelling the rest of HS2, which means that wouldn't actually do anything like what it was supposed to do on the tin. It's just basically a fast train from London to Birmingham, and it doesn't even go into the main London stations. So it does look as if it's an absolute mess for the Tories. And as one person, I think it was Isabel Oakeshott, pointed out on Talk TV, Talk Radio this morning, that there is a sense amongst the Tory party that they don't actually want to win. They've had enough.
Well, I think one of the things that's happening is people like Suella Braverman and others are manoeuvring to be the follow-on Tory leader after Sunak loses the election.
You mean a kind of an opposition leader kind of thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in other words, what's now happening is because the smart money knows they're going to lose, those who are hardcore Tories like Suella Braverman, she wants to be the leader of the opposition and therefore have a route to number 10 by being the leader
of the
opposition.
Isn't it interesting, the difference between...
And she's not the only one.
...the States and the UK, whereas Boris Johnson, almost forgot his name there for a minute, Boris Johnson was hoofed out, although he was actually an election winner. Donald Trump as well. There was an attempt to impeach him, but it's Boris hasn't really said anything, has he? Much. He hasn't been making any kind of political speeches, and I wonder if he had. This is maybe the system over in the Anglo-Zionist Empire, that if you keep your mouth shut like Boris has after being elbowed out, that maybe you'll survive. But Trump is being impeached every few weeks. Anyway, let's have a listen now to a speech by the US presidential candidate Donald Trump, speaking in Michigan to the auto workers, and maybe maybe before we hear that, we can hear a little bit of, from you, Martin. Apparently, the auto workers over the union of auto workers over in the United States see Trump as one of their heroes, which is bizarre that the, a Republican rather than a Democrat might be, or maybe he's just trying to spin it that way, Trump reckons that he's saved the American auto industry, and a lot of auto workers do vote for Trump. So is that just nonsense? Is he not done that at all?
Well, the place where he went to speak is a non-union plant. So nobody in that plant where he's speaking is a member of a trade union. Although they were brandishing placards that had been given to them saying unions for Trump, none of those people in that room were in a trade union.
Very interesting. Well, thanks for that. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Trump talking about this whole battle. You know, if you're rejected by the deep state and you try like Trump to get re-elected, well, you know, it's impeachment time, baby.
For decades, you've watched rotten and crooked politicians like Biden treat American jobs as disposable and American workers as expendable. They sat back and got rich by taking bribes to let other countries rape and pillage our jobs and our wealth. That's what happened. Joe Biden claims to be the most pro-union president in history. Nonsense. His entire career has been an act of economic treason and union destruction. He's destroyed unions, shipping millions of American jobs overseas while personally taking money from foreign nations hand over fist. Look at the money he got from China. Look at what's coming out, China.
There's a little extract from a long speech by Trump in Michigan to auto workers, Martin. Is he right to be appealing to them?
Well, obviously he wants to appeal to them. If he's going to win, they're a constituency that he needs to win over. But it's as has been pointed out in the Guardian, the people in the room are none of them members of a trade union, because the bosses in that plant don't want trade unions in the plant.
You've already said that twice. I mean, the point surely is that Biden's policies mean that much of American industry is no longer going to be protected by their own government, and much of the, say, for example, the cars are going to be imported.
Well, I mean, that's the policy of the Clinton administration going back years, and it was the policy of the Reagan administration before that.
Why are the Democrats doing this?
Because the corporations can make more money for their shareholders by having the work done in China cheaper than they can have it done at home.
In fact, we remember David Southwell telling us about that conversation he had with Tony Blair, saying, well, look, you know, this is my, if you decide you want to regulate Kit Kats, then I'm going to start making Kit Kats abroad because I can do it for half the price can here.
That's right. And, of course, it's actually boosted the stock market in the US to do that. So Apple and so on moved their production lines to China and elsewhere, and it was a win-win for the stockholders. Now, of course, Trump is now trying to whip up opposition to this, but Trump himself is an anti-union employer. He's never allowed any unions in any business he's ever run, and there he is pretending to be a friend of the unions. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Well,
and I'm not saying that Biden's a friend of the unions. He does pretend to be a friend of the unions. He isn't one either. And the same is obviously true of Starmer in this country. Lots of trade unionists are very, very critical of the direction he's taking the Labour Party in. But then, of course, they don't determine the policy, do they?
Who does?
Who determines the policy is the usual oligarchs that determine policy. And they either have exactly what they want from the Tories or pretty much everything they want from the Labour Party. Unless somebody can break in from the outside, like RFK, Jeremy Corbyn or whatever, Syriza in Greece. But then they get run over by a bus and we're all back to square one, aren't we?
Well, these net zero policies are definitely, it seems to me, at the heart of what the Conservatives are going to be discussing this week. And it may be that that whole announcement about the new oil field is part of that. A regular contributor to GB News, James Melville, shared the live BBC graph on the social media platform Twitter, formerly known as X.
I know,
but it's just so annoying the way they always say it. This is just literally looking at the different you know, the basically emissions from all these various different countries. China's emissions now exceed all developed nations combined, for example, Martin. So if anything's going to have going to be done about climate change by going to net zero, it's going to be the Chinese that do it. I mean, it's apparently we have 1% of global emissions. And of course, as we heard from the guy who was talking on the 6 o'clock news, BBC News, about this new oil field, the actual amount that the British contribute is minuscule.
All right, I'm not necessarily in favour of net zero, so I'm not going to defend that. But I will make this point, Tony: the Chinese produce the most emissions at the moment. Of course, there's millions of more of them than there are of us. And the historical production by Britain is actually larger, much larger than that. There's a historical
legacy. Because this only makes sense if you look at it per capita, really.
Yeah, yes,
it?
Per capita, and also with historical emissions. And the other thing, of course, in China, a lot of the emissions they're making so they can produce stuff which ends up in Walmart and ends up in Aldi and Tesco in this country. So ultimately, consumers in Britain are creating the carbon footprint which is given to the Chinese. The Chinese are exporting most of their stuff, and we're consuming it. It's our carbon footprint. It's the wealthy people in the world who've got the biggest carbon footprints. The super wealthy and the middle class in the West. Poor people in developing countries have got minuscule contribution to all of this. And if we're going to industrialise those countries, and we should, there's going to have to be some equity in all of this. But there's not going to be any equity in all of this, because in actual fact, we're at war with China and Russia, and they're not going to cooperate with anything to do with climate change or anything else. If we're trying to destroy them, they're going to destroy us rather than cooperate.
In a way, it's a bogus article, isn't it? Because what they're saying is UK has got very low emissions. Well, this is really, it has to be, if you're not doing it per capita, then you're wasting your time.
That's
because,
right.
Because, yeah, I mean, let's just have a look. If your policy changes, it changes for a lot more people in China than it does in the UK. So at the top of the list are India, USA and China, which of course are much more populous. Actually, Russia does quite well at 4, because that's, I think what I need to do is I need to sit down and do a few calculations with this rather misleading Daily Express article to see, you know, what is the population in each of these countries, because that's the only thing that really makes any sense to me.
Well, that's right, Tony, but I'll just add, as I said earlier, you've got to bring in the historical emissions and also the fact that the consumer goods are exported from China, yeah, and India. That's why they're making, as they produce these goods, they're creating carbon. That's all I'll say.
I don't think historical. Why historical?
No, the historical.
You seem to think that we have to pay for people who were burning coal in the Industrial Revolution.
In the Industrial Revolution, we industrialised our country, which is why our living standards are so much higher than in India, for example, which was definitely a country.
Well,
which
shouldn't we all be, you know, levelling up rather than a race to the bottom?
No, well,
Yes, we should. And actually, quite a lot of this Sustainable Development Goals and the net zero policies are about basically a race to the bottom, a deindustrialization, decivilization.
That is the argument of the right in the West. I would argue.
It's just a common sense. It's not left or right.
No.
Yes, it is. Yeah, because if you don't have industry and you don't have energy, then you don't have civilization.
I totally agree with that, Tony. I'm not necessarily in favour of net zero, but equity demands that poor countries, particularly India and China, which were de-developed by Britain, we dominated the politics and economy of both countries for 2 centuries, and that's why they started off very poor at the beginning of the 20th century compared to us. And ultimately, that's not fair. And ultimately, they've got to industrialise, and that means they're going to have to use energy.
Well,
now, if we're going to reduce carbon emissions, that means the wealthy people in the world are going to have to make sacrifices. You can't expect poor people to make sacrifices.
It's not necessary to sacrifice at all.
No,
Just let me finish, Martin. You're really bad at just talking over. As soon as I actually reply to you, you just talk over me. Is that we need to have, say, for example, rather than to just tell people they've got to get rid of their cars, we need to have cheap or free public transport that people can use, like we had in the 1960s and early 1970s, very cheap public transport, which was being run at cost. And if you're going to do that, then people don't need their cars.
Well, I agree with that. But, of course, that would imply that you had a planned economy and a bit of socialism. Yeah. Which, is, of course, is off the agenda.
No, it isn't. It isn't off well, the agenda. Not on this programme.
Well,
and
no, I know, but I'm
not
just saying.
Not in any sensible living
well,
room in this country.
Well, exactly.
For anyone that living well, still
right.
alive that can remember
the problem
cheap public transport.
The problem is path dependency. Once you've made crappy decisions.
Like HS2.
You're then stuck with them.
Well, yeah. You're not, actually. What you do is you just say, right, this is, we're not throwing any more good money after bad. A bit like, I keep thinking about Hinkley and all the money that's been being spent there and Chris Busby's contention that actually it's just about the money that's being spent on the project, not actually delivering a project which is going to do any good for society at all.
Well, I mean, the thing about HS2 is what they should have done is build the Liverpool to Leeds line.
Yep, absolutely.
That's what they
yep,
should have done. Yep. Before you do anything else, do that.
Or the money that's been spent on some new line, just beef up the existing lines and actually reopen some of those lines too. And actually, let's just nationalise it, folks. Anyway, we're going to come back after the break and we're going to be hearing a little bit about Justin Trudeau. Naughty, naughty.
Let us pray. We pray today for all musicians and remember especially those who sing and play in churches and cathedrals across this nation. We pray for those on the summer course here in Cambridge at this time and for all those who teach and inspire. O God, who in the gift of music hath given us a revelation of thy divine beauty, teach us to love thee in all thy gifts, and so to devote ourselves in all our work to thy glory, that through music we may raise men and women from the sorrows of this world to the enjoyment of thy holy peace. Through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. We pray too for this college and university, and for all universities and places of further education. We remember those who are preparing to begin their student life, and we pray for all those who have helped them to reach this new chapter. Almighty God, we beseech thee with thy gracious favour to behold our universities, colleges, and schools, that knowledge and the love of truth may be increased amongst us, and all good learning flourish and serve the common good. Bless all who teach and all who learn, and grant that in humility of heart they may ever look unto thee who art the fountain of all wisdom. Through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. Finally, we pray for those we love, and those for whom we have a deep care or concern at this time. We pray for our own lives of faith, for a deepening trust and a more loving spirit. O God, who art peace everlasting, whose chosen reward is the gift of peace, and who has taught us that the peacemakers are thy children, pour thy peace into our hearts, that everything discordant may vanish, and all that makes for peace be loved and sought by us, day by day, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. The College Prayer. Bless, O Lord, the work of this college, which is called by the name of thy beloved disciple, and grant that love of the brethren and all sound learning may ever grow and prosper here, to thy honour and glory, and to the good of thy people, who with the Father and the Holy Spirit livest and reignest one God, world without end. Amen. The grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, and the love of God, and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us all evermore. Amen. Our final hymn is based on an old Irish prayer for protection, Be Thou My Vision.
Here begins the fourth chapter of the second book of the Kings, in which the prophet Elisha shows overflowing compassion for a widow and her children. The wife of a member of the company of prophets cried to Elisha, "Your servant, my husband, is dead. And you know that your servant feared the Lord. But a creditor has come to take my two children as slaves." Elisha said to her, "What shall I do for you? Tell me, what do you have in the house?" She answered, "Your servant has nothing in the house except a jar of oil." He said, "Go outside, borrow vessels from all your neighbors, empty vessels, and not just a few. Then go in and shut the door behind you and your children, and start pouring into all these vessels. When each is full, set it aside." So she left him and shut the door behind her and her children, and they kept bringing vessels to her, and she kept pouring. When the vessels were full, she said to her son, "Bring me another vessel." But he said to her, "There are no more." Then the oil stopped flowing. She came and told the man of God, and he said, "Go, sell the oil and pay your debts, and you and your children can live on the rest." Here ends the first lesson.
Amen. Amen. I've been lost and so afraid. Give me purpose, guide my way. If I was the devil, I'd make kids question their gender, make them normalize sexual offenders. I'd make sinning seem cool and God seem like a fool, and tell people his commandments are a bunch of stupid rules that are meant to be broken. The demons I've awoken would be at the award shows right out in the open. I control all celebrities and words that they've spoken, make them think I'm God, I'm the real one that's chosen. Make them hate religion and abandon their traditions. I put hidden messaging in all the movies for the children. I would pick the worst people in the world as politicians, carrying out my decisions, working for me on my mission. Cause division in your families, normalize blasphemy, confuse the world, make them live inside a false reality. Have them glued to their phones, feeling sad and alone. Have them trusting Dr. Fauci and hating Robert Malone. Amen. Amen. I've been lost and so afraid. Give me purpose, guide my way. Was the devil, I put cheating in the movies. I'd make artists praise me like Sam Smith and Lil Uzi. I'd normalize being unhealthy and call it beauty. I would make sure everybody knew me and pursued me. I would make them all fight when they're about to unite. Make the whites hate the blacks and the blacks hate the whites. Kids will choose fame, have them blinded by my light. I will have them all thinking that the darkness seemed bright, and that good seemed evil, and that evil seemed right. They should all feel my wrath and just laugh at God's might. Infiltrate Big Pharma, make the cure really harm ya. I'd control the food supply and sabotage all the farmers. But I ain't the devil, I'm a God-fearing man. All I had to do was change the person in the mirror, fam. I kick Satan out the car, I know God's steering, man. Every single time I pray, I know God hear it, man. Amen. 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 I've been lost and so afraid. Give me purpose, guide my way. Amen. Amen. Help me see another day. Oh Lord, to you I pray. Amen.
Here begins the second chapter of the Gospel according to St. John. Jesus reveals the startling generosity and grace within the life he comes to bring. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what concern is that to you and to me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now standing there were 6 stone water jars for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to them, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them up to the brim. He said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the chief steward." So they took it. When the steward tasted the water that had become wine and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the steward called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and then the inferior wine after the guests have become drunk. But you have kept the good wine until now." Jesus did this, the first of his signs, in Cana of Galilee, and revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Here ends the second lesson.
Is that something that the British government is looking at, the idea of a vaccine passport specifically to allow people to come and go in the months ahead?
No, we're not. Vaccines are not mandated in this country, as Boris Johnson's quite rightly reminded Parliament. You know, that's not how we do things in the UK. We do them by consent. We yet don't know what the impact of vaccines on transmission is, and it would be discriminatory.
Hey, yo, they lie and they cheat. They were born to deceive. In the land of the lost, they mislead the naive. Gotta turn the telly off, because it keeps you asleep. The reason for this pandemic is a digital idea. Yo, they lie and they cheat. We follow like we're sheep in a Freemasonic system. They don't want us free. The age of Aquarius, the rise of machines. We have to rebel and fight the digital ID. Ayo, how many times have they fed us lies and gone back on their word and then tried to deny? How many times have they committed crimes against humanity for the greater good, but yo, we got disguised? How many times are we gonna ignore the signs? Without the passport, you can't buy food because you get declined. How many times will you get pushed until you grow a spine? We live in a society where blind will lead the blind. We've entered a new age. They're priming us like souffle. They're trying to introduce a credit system like it's doomsday. I don't care if you think I'm crazy. I might sound it to you. They got the old order, now upgrading it to new. There's no conspiracy, it's here to see. I don't know how you can't agree. Digital ID is what the Bible calls mark of the beast. And I ain't down with that. That's why I'm taking to the streets. There's so much negativity. I'm trying to balance it with peace. Yo, they lie and they cheat. They were born to deceive. In the land of the lost, they mislead the naive. Gotta turn the telly off, cause it keeps you asleep. The reason for this pandemic is a digital idea. Yo, they lie and they cheat. We follow like we're sheep in a Freemasonic system. They don't want us free. The age of Aquarius, the rise of machines. We have to rebel and fight the digital ID. We've all seen the films. They're programming the people, conditioning them to accept the next part of the sequel. All they want is a predictable society. They want obedience and want you to comply with the elite. But I ain't having it. I've always been the blackest sheep. I'm banging on this system, seeing cracks in the concrete. I'll never give up. Yo, I'll never retreat. That's why you catch me with my megaphone up in the street. Shops soon cashless. They want it digitalized. They want to merge it with your passport that's being designed. You can dismiss it as conspiracy, but show me the lie. Technocracy is coming. You gotta open your eyes. These lot of cycles, they need us. We don't need them. Even the Terminator told you himself.
Screw your freedom.
We think we're free, but we live in tyranny. I'd rather stand for something than to live on my knees. Ayo, they lie and they cheat. They were born to deceive. In the land of the lost, they mislead the naive. Gotta turn the telly off, cause it keeps you asleep. The reason for this pandemic is a digital idea. Yo, they lie and they cheat. We follow like we're sheep in a Freemasonic system. They don't want us free. The age of Aquarius, the rise of machines. We have to rebel and fight the digital ID.
Okay, so there won't be a vaccine passport?
No, that's not being planned.
At all, ever.
Well, not happening. I certainly am not planning to introduce any vaccine passports.
Eventually, there will be sort of this digital immunity proof that, you know, will help facilitate the global reopening up.
Yeah, right. And Michael Gove with this Mark of the Beast microchip thing. So anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. That those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner on the talkradio.org.uk stream and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. You heard there the Chapel of St. John's College in Cambridge, and also Hi-Rez. Hi-Rez, If I Were the Devil, and also Nate. I mean, he really is wonderful, isn't he, with this whole digital ID. Not sure of the dates of those, obviously, over the last 2 or 3 years. But please do send me in any, you know, kind of tunes that you hear the youngsters play that you like. Some of this stuff I heard down on opposite Downing Street, amazingly, with this quite nice little sound system that I asked them to turn it down a little bit because it was too loud. But, you know, I think just a little bit of background, rap, particularly that kind of thing, goes down extremely well. Anyway, we're on the talkradio.org.uk stream and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, which you can download. Please don't do it from the Google App Store. We've got a nice little app store on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, a link to it anyway. We can also download the Rumble app because Google Play have blocked that as part of the, well, who are they? The Deep State, the New World Order, obviously decided they want to cancel Rumble because Rumble don't hate Russell Brand enough. It's all rather pathetic, but that's the way they do things. So it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling, again. Martin, let's just start with this whole Trudeau business this week. I mean, really shocking, isn't it, to see something like this playing out in a national parliament? It's almost as if somebody somewhere thought that no one was going to care if an ex-Waffen-SS soldier was given a standing ovation. And this time it was in the Canadian Parliament. Let's just have a listen to what happened last week.
We have here in the chamber today Ukrainian-Canadian war veteran from the Second World War who fought the Ukrainian independence against the Russians and continues to support the troops today, even at his age of 98.
Well, what astonishes me about this is just general knowledge of history should have led them to conclude that this guy, if he fought against the Russians in the Second World War, was fighting for the Germans. It should be obvious. I mean, you know, don't they have basic history and education in Canadian schools? And if from their own point of view, it's backfired spectacularly, because it was always going to be the case that people were going to point out, hang on a minute, this guy's from the Waffen-SS. I mean, various Jewish organisations in Canada immediately spoke up and said, what's this about? As they would.
So what's going on there? How does somebody like that slip through the net?
I think what's happened is...
Maybe there is no net.
What's happened is that what happened at the end of World War II is that Canada openly welcomed lots of ex-Ukrainian Nazis into the country. They were given a very easy passage into the country because they were regarded as anti-communists and therefore reliable, and the Americans were pushing it. Why don't you take a load of these Ukrainians for us? And then they were allowed to settle, and they became quite a significant political bloc within Canada. And Chrystia Freeland, who is, I think, the Deputy Prime Minister now, but she used to be the Foreign Minister.
Ah, she was one of the Bilderbergers.
Yes,
year.
That's right. But her maternal grandfather was a very, very active in pro-Nazi journalism during the war, whipping up hatred against Jews, Poles, communists, etc. And because they've become very, very embedded into Canadian society to the point where they've got overconfident about what they can and can't get away with. Because Chrystia Freeland was standing there right next to Justin Trudeau, and she was clapping away, enthusiastically. Incidentally, of course, there's actually photographs of Zelensky. When the guy comes in, he's actually doing a Nazi salute. At one stage, he does a kind of clenched fist salute, but the first thing he did was do a Nazi salute, as, of course, did Boris Johnson in Kiev a few weeks ago. There's a picture of him giving a Nazi salute from a platform with a long load of people at Kiev University, where he was given an honorary degree for being so pro their policy, and he hasn't completely given up on talking politics. He's basically been pushing the idea that he's the one person who stood firm on Ukraine.
Well, this guy's name, the ex Waffen-SS soldier, was Yaroslav Hunka. And what transpired almost immediately was various people around the world started circulating this, and one of them was a British blogger who goes by the name of Warren Thornton, and so I thought it'd be quite interesting to hear what he had to say over the weekend. I mean, this sort of exploded at the beginning of the week, but it was only because why was it exactly, Martin?
Well, I think that they shouldn't have done it, even from their own point of view. And once they had done it, they've been in kind of damage limitation mode ever since. I mean, the Speaker of the Parliament has had to resign as the Speaker, and there is talk that Trudeau himself may have to resign. Maybe Chrystia Freeland should resign, since she is, in fact, the biggest supporter of the Ukrainian regime in the Canadian government. But, they'll just try and bluff it out, I presume.
There is obviously some sort of connection between Canada and Ukraine. You've just explained it. Why has it not been, surely this sort of, long-term connection between the Ukrainians and Canada should have been exposed by the West. So saying, well, actually, in fact, by the Western press, saying that this is a potential problem.
Yeah, but don't forget that they were welcomed with open arms in the first place in the 1940s, because there was always a policy to try and smash the Soviet Union and then subsequently the Russians. That's if you were a Jewish refugee from the occupied Europe, the Zionists insisted that all Jewish refugees had to go to Palestine. So they wouldn't let them in the United States. They lobbied to make sure that people couldn't go to the United States. Most Jewish refugees at the end of the war wanted to go to the United States. But the Zionist lobbied for that they had to go to Palestine. So a lot of the people on the Exodus, for example, which was sent to Palestine with loads of refugees on, they didn't want to go to Israel. They wanted to go to the United States. But the Ukrainian Nazis, on the other hand, were extracted from the Ukraine because they were going to be used as a mechanism for fighting the Soviet Union, and many of them went back. At one stage, Chrystia Freeland went back to the Ukraine, having studied Russian studies in Canada, and she was involved in attempts to set up cells to carry out sabotage against the Soviet regime and so on and so forth. So they were seen as a kind of Schwerpunkt of the attack on the Soviet Union. And the same thing happened, of course, with many German Nazis who were rehabilitated, like Reinhard Gehlen, who used to head the Gestapo, ends up heading up the BND.
Try and listen now to Warren Thornton, who was the blogger who was trying to discuss this at the weekend. Well, in fact, he did discuss it, saying, what's SS Nazi doing getting a standing ovation in the Canadian Parliament?
One thing I can confirm for you, and just let me pull this name out of the hat for you, is this gentleman, and this is a story. A 98-year-old Ukrainian SS man called Yaroslav Gunka, who served in the 14th SS Volunteer Division of Galicia, which was made up of Ukrainian nationalists. Now, they were sent to Slovakia to quell any uprisings there. There was an attack on a village of Ninza Boka, where the Ukrainian SS men stormed into the pub, interrogated the menfolk, and executed five villagers as alleged partisans. One of them, Cyril Zaradnak, was just 15 years of age when he died, calling out for his mother. His crime was having a Russian coin in his pocket, and they took him out and executed him. They carried out many other atrocities all over Slovakia at the time, and this is the crime of this particular gentleman and his unit were responsible for all sorts of RAPEs and all sorts of disgusting acts, including executions and suppression. It is interesting to note that this gentleman, along with Zelensky, in front of a crowd, and the video is on my Twitter, in front of the entire Canadian Parliament, was paraded as a hero and stood up and received a standing ovation from Trudeau and his parliament. If you wanted any further proof of the madness of what we are supporting You need look no further than this. When, as a group of people, did we decide to honour people who'd butchered children and villagers as part of the Waffen-SS, and then invite them to Parliament and give them a standing ovation for their deeds?
Well, interestingly enough, as you know, there is now a spat developing between the Ukrainians and the Poles, partly about the grain deal and the Polish farmers being basically bankrupted by Ukrainian grain. But they have actually called for this guy to be extradited to Poland to stand trial for killing ethnic Poles in the 1940s. Because most of them were, I mean, the Warsaw Uprising was finally crushed by the Galician SS. The Germans withdrew and let them finish everybody off. They, you know, that's what happened. So, lots of historical chickens are coming home to roost.
Well, they are for Warren Thornton too. Warren was a soldier for 6 years and has undertaken, as he says on his little Patreon profile, aid work in war-torn countries. His military embassy aid work and independent journalist contacts mean he's well placed to have a unique insight into most conflicts around the world. His extensive travel and inquiring mind enable him, he's writing about himself here, to investigate situations the mainstream media is unable or unwilling to do for the public. Well, he's obviously a well-connected chap. I'd never come across him before, but he was one of the people who was doing the digging on this story and made sure it made it around the web. Obviously, the mainstream media were not interested until it was picked up as an issue. There was an article on Sputnik Live about a UK journalist who was then bizarrely arrested. UK journalist arrested for malinformation after exposing Trudeau's appalling Nazi. This is James Tweedy writing this on Sputnik International. Free speech advocates have warned that the British government's online safety bill could be used to crack down on anyone questioning the official narrative on issues from the COVID-19 pandemic to the conflict in Ukraine. A British independent journalist has been arrested after he condemned the Canadian Parliament's lauding of a Ukrainian Nazi Waffen-SS member. Warren Thornton was hosting an edition of his webcast, The Real Truth, on the evening of Sunday, September the 24th, when police officers knocked at his door. The video blogger has been critical on social media of NATO's support to Ukraine in its conflict with Russia. Well, Martin, he was taken down here to Bristol as part of the regional cybercrime unit for the whole of the South West, which includes Wiltshire, Gloucestershire, Constabulary, Devon and Cornwall and Avon and Somerset. So it's one of these weird units that isn't really quite part of one of the constabularies. It's a bit of everybody. And they turned up on his door, and when he refused to sign something, they arrested him. Now, he hasn't made a big thing about him about this himself, but the idea that someone should be actually arrested for telling the truth about this seems to be as a result of certain people around the world, I'm not sure quite who, saying, well, we don't really want these independent bloggers making a fuss about this because it's been very embarrassing around the world. So this is Sunday evening now, as this story is developing, an arrest.
Well, that's absolutely extraordinary, and I ask listeners who are living in this country to contemplate the fact that they are paying their taxes for this cyber unit to go around and kick this guy's door down.
I don't think they did kick the door down.
Well, they shouldn't be going around to his house at all, should they?
He was complaining because he was arrested and then de-arrested, didn't sign anything, and I do hope he takes these police to court for wrongful arrest. But then he had a long train ride home. Now, it might have been that he was arrested so late in the day that it would have been difficult for him to get home that day.
Well, it's harassment at the very least, isn't it? And it's an extraordinary waste of British taxpayers' money, and at the very least you could say that. And it's also even more sinister than that, because we're basically being primed for a war with Russia in which at least 500,000 people have died already.
So as this suddenly begins to turn into a story on Monday and Tuesday this week, it seems that as it's becoming a diplomatic row and Trudeau is going to have to deal with it, and the Jewish lobby have got hold of the information, the Israelis have got hold of it, why are you cheering this Waffen-SS Nazi in the Canadian Parliament? That the orders go down, who has been spreading this information, they find an ex-serviceman who's a bit like you and I doing a weekly blog.
Well, it's quite extraordinary, isn't it? Why is it that they feel that it's their job to go around chasing people like him down? Because they're telling people the obvious truth. And, of course, the mainstream media have not completely ignored this in many countries. But, of course, there's been a huge attempt to try and, make it all go away. And that's because there's a huge pro-war lobby which wants this to just... It's turned into an embarrassment, but they want it to be got rid of as quickly as possible so it can get back to the killing.
The timing of this arrest is interesting because this was developing. It happened on Friday. It was developing over the weekend, and there was someone somewhere out there tracing who it was that had realised that this guy was an ex-Waffen-SS person who had been spreading this truth. And so someone was set on there to arrest him. Anyway, within a few hours on Monday morning, Justin Trudeau was forced to go on TV and apologise.
In a few moments, I will address the House in front of all Canadians, in front of Jewish people here and around the world, and Ukrainians, to offer Parliament's unreserved apologies for what happened on Friday. The Speaker was solely responsible for the invitation and recognition of this man and has wholly accepted that responsibility and stepped down. This was a mistake that has deeply embarrassed Parliament and Canada. All of us who were in this House on Friday regret deeply having stood and clapped, even though we did so unaware of the context. It was a horrendous violation of the memory of the millions of people who died in the Holocaust, and it was deeply, deeply painful for Jewish people. It also hurt Polish people, Roma people, 2SLGBTQI+ people, disabled people, racialized people, and the many millions who were targeted by the Nazi genocide. Every year, there are fewer and fewer Holocaust survivors to share firsthand the horrors of what they experienced, and it is therefore incumbent upon us all to ensure that no one ever forgets what happened. I also want to reiterate how deeply sorry Canada is for the situation this put President Zelensky and the Ukrainian delegation in. It is extremely troubling to think that this egregious error is being politicized by Russia and its supporters to provide false propaganda about what Ukraine is fighting for. Friday's joint session was about what Canada stands for, about our steadfast support of Ukraine's fight against Putin's brutality, lies, and violence. It was a moment to celebrate and acknowledge the sacrifices of Ukrainians as they fight for their democracy, their freedom, their language and culture, and for peace. This is the side Canada was on in World War II, and this is the side we are on today.
So, that's Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau making an apology a few hours after the arrest of Warren Thornton here in the UK.
Yeah, well, I find it quite extraordinary that anybody... I mean, you'd imagine that the people in the Ukraine, the Canadian Parliament, must be relatively educated people. They must have done the equivalent of GCSE history. This guy who fought against the Russians in the Ukraine in that era must have been a pro-Nazi militant. There's no other possibility. And they must have known when he was said he fought against the Russians and for Ukrainian independence in World War II, the only people who did that were pro-Nazis. And everybody should surely have known. As soon as they said that, you could have, anybody sitting in the room, you know, many teenagers in this country who've been properly educated would know immediately he must be a Nazi.
I mean, it does seem as if this whole Nazi business and the connection between Zelensky, Ukraine, and the Azov battalion and the history of Ukraine is a massive Achilles heel, actually.
It is. It is, but of course they get away with it because if things are repeated sufficiently loudly and with sufficient emphasis, then people start to believe what they're told, because they just do. It's one of the things that psychologists have understood. If something is repeated, people believe it because they just think, well, if they're repeating it so often, it must be true. Putin is Hitler. He's invaded Ukraine to try and take over the world. And we've got to learn the lessons of World War II, that we've got to stand up to this, that and the other. Of course, what we learn from history is that people learn nothing from history. Putin has intervened in the civil war in the Ukraine because we changed the government in the Ukraine to one of a government which was congenitally hostile to Russian people and their interests. That's the source of the war. The Russians basically have tried to avoid fighting for over the 8 years since the Minsk agreements were signed.
I don't know if you've seen anything. I've been looking around for any statement by Zelensky since he was there clapping this SS Nazi guy.
Well, Zelensky must have known that he was an ex-Nazi, because Zelensky's Ukrainian, so he must have known. But don't forget, Zelensky...
He hasn't really made any... As far as I can see, he hasn't made any statement about it at all.
Well, of course, the best thing to do when something like this happens is shut up and hope it all goes away.
He wants
which is pretty much what they're doing.
Arms from the Canadians. In fact, he's over there to make his massive appeal. Well, it does. I wonder if the Canadians are going to help them at all. Anyway, the result of it, of course, as we heard from Justin Trudeau there, is that Canada's Speaker of the House bears full responsibility for this, and he's going to resign. So is that
well, I think what they've done is they've said, right, he was the one who decided...
Throwing him under a bus.
Okay. Whereas in actual fact, I'm pretty sure that Trudeau and Chrystia Freeland must have known what was going on. Chrystia Freeland certainly knew what was going on, because she's of Ukrainian origin. They just thought they were going to get away with it, I think. And it just shows how sloppy they are.
Hooray for Warren Thornton. I think we should get him on this programme. If I can, I will.
He's a local, he certainly should.
Well,
yeah.
He's not that local. He said it's somewhere... Whatever he lives is a bit of a train ride away from Bristol, and it was a bit of a
pain. But they brought him here for his interrogation.
Well, it's ridiculous, isn't it? It's so disgusting. Anyway, right. I mean, I would imagine that is one of the problems. We haven't got proper oversight of these regional forces. Okay, so there will be some proper oversight in the same Wiltshire Constabulary, Gloucestershire Constabulary, wherever he lives, but this is the cybercrime unit that's done this. So anyway, let's go back to Canada and have a listen to Canada's House Speaker Rota resigning.
It's with a heavy heart that I rise to inform members of my resignation as Speaker of the House of Commons. It has been my greatest honour as a parliamentarian to have been elected by you, my peers, to serve as the Speaker of the House of Commons for the 43rd and 44th Parliament. I have acted as your humble servant of this House, carrying out the important responsibilities of this position to the very best of my abilities. The work of this House is above any of us. Therefore, I must step down as your Speaker. I reiterate my profound regret for my error in recognizing an individual in the House during the joint address to Parliament of President Zelensky. That public recognition has caused pain to individuals and communities, including the Jewish community in Canada and around the world, in addition to survivors of Nazi atrocities in Poland, among other nations. I accept full responsibility for my actions. My resignation is effective at the end of the sitting day tomorrow, Wednesday, September 27th, to allow preparations for the election of a new speaker. Until that time, the deputy speakers will chair the House proceedings. Thank you. Merci.
Well, there's got to be a little bit of French at the end there, but there he goes. The fall guy.
I think that's the case. I'm quite sure Chrystia Freeland would have known what was going on here. He wouldn't have done that on his own. I think she's been a very pernicious influence, and she's basically, as I say, they've got very overconfident about what they can get away with. They need to keep quiet about the Nazi background of the current, you know, the current government in Ukraine. But they can't help themselves, because they are Ukrainian nationalists. They feel that they're justified, and if you read their stuff, they still try to justify what they did and what side they were on, and that was all justified and so on. And they've been allowed to do that in Canada for many years. and they've just been allowed to basically they've been given a carte blanche to push their agenda, and they've got overconfidence because they are at the end of the day an immigrant minority in Canada that only arrived in the 1940s.
So the Canadian opposition, who are they? Do you know much about Canadian politics? I'm interested to, you know, did they really make the most of this? And this is what you hope in a democracy, is that the knife is definitely going into Trudeau's back, but let's...
The fact is the Conservatives in Canada are even more pro-Ukraine than the Liberals, and the National Democrats, who are the equivalent of the left here, they're like the Labour Party. They also clapped along, perhaps through ignorance.
Well, I know. What I'm interested in is, once it had been revealed that they'd been clapping a Nazi, what did the opposition say? So let's have a listen now to Trudeau's actual apology in Parliament, rather than to the press, which he gave before he went to Parliament.
On behalf of all of us in this House, I would like to present unreserved apologies for what took place on Friday, and to President Zelensky and the Ukrainian delegation for the position they were put in. For all of us who were present to have unknowingly recognized this individual was a terrible mistake and a violation of the memory of those who suffered grievously at the hands of the Nazi regime.
The Honourable Leader of the Official Opposition.
Did the Prime Minister's national security, intelligence, or diplomatic officials vet the names of the people that the Prime Minister allowed within mere feet of President Zelensky?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the privilege and responsibilities and rights of parliamentarians are sacrosanct, and that the Leader of the Opposition would be suggesting that any visitor to this House should be vetted by the government of the day is actually a grievous attack on the rights and privileges of parliamentarians. However, if the Leader of the Opposition or the Speaker or anyone wants our intelligence agencies to vet any of their guests, we would be more than happy to do that in respect of parliamentary rights.
The Honourable Leader of the Official Opposition.
The Prime Minister has just said that he allowed the president of a war-torn country, who is perhaps the biggest target of false propaganda and of potential assassinations, to be surrounded by hundreds of people who had not been vetted for their security background, their potential risks that they present, or in this case, the massive diplomatic disasters that they could have brought to that event. Is he really saying that he did absolutely nothing to protect the Ukrainian president from all of those many risks?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
The facts are well known here. The Speaker issued the invitation, delivered the recognition, and has taken full responsibility. The Leader of the Opposition knows that not one parliamentarian was aware. But the truth does not matter to this Leader of the Opposition. He distorts, misleads, aims to confuse, all for partisan gain. It's all he knows how to do.
So I thought British politics was dysfunctional, but that was a completely, it was an insane kind of intervention by the opposition. It wasn't actually making any useful points whatsoever.
Well, I mean, the main point he was making is that we've embarrassed Zelensky. Isn't that terrible? But of course, the Conservative opposition, I presume that was the leader of the Conservative Party, they clapped as well. And nobody should clap somebody who fought for the Ukrainians against the Russians in World War II. It's obvious that they must. There's nothing else they could have been. Ukrainians fought in the Soviet forces.
An example.
They fought against these Ukrainian Nazis, and they, you know, the only Ukrainians who fought against the Soviets were the Nazis.
So what is it? The Emperor's New Clothes or just groupthink?
I think it's groupthink. I think they've been exposed. I mean, what's happening is that the story, the narrative behind this whole conflict is gradually falling apart. But you could see the conservative leader of the opposition there trying to maintain the narrative. The real problem here is that poor old Zelensky has been embarrassed rather than we've all clapped a Nazi.
Yeah. Moving on to what about Nagorno-Karabakh?
Artsakh, Tony.
What's that?
That's the Armenians call it Artsakh.
But apparently it's no more. Everything's finished. Right. Nagorno-Karabakh is gone. We keep hearing about this, and I'm always suspicious when they have it again and again and again and again, day after day after day on the news. Who are the main protagonists? I think there was quite a lot of exaggeration of the number of Armenians who had fled Nagorno-Karabakh. There was actually only half the number of that had arrived as migrants in Lampedusa, I was figuring out the other day. So what's going on there?
Well, it's an old conflict, which has been going on since the breakup of the Soviet Union. The borders inside the Soviet Union were decided by the Soviet Union. They were either decided by Lenin or Stalin or others like Khrushchev, who put Crimea into Ukraine on a whim. So Nagorno-Karabakh is, or Artsakh, as the Armenian nationalists call it, is an Armenian enclave in the mountains of Western Azerbaijan. Armenians are Armenian Orthodox, that's their general religious orientation. Azerbaijanis are generally Shia Muslims. So there's actually...
But these people can get along fine normally. There's agitation going on, isn't there? Like, for example, someone blew up a petrol station. Someone is trying to cause trouble.
The trouble really broke out at the end of the Soviet Union, because the people in Nagorno-Karabakh declared independence as Artsakh, and the regime in Baku, which was led by Shia Muslims, they felt that this was, you can't just declare independence. They were given an autonomous region by Stalin. I mean, so in other words, the region was autonomous, but within Azerbaijan.
What I'm trying to say is this is the main thing that seems to be going on nowadays. So we've got a part of Ukraine which has tried to secede from Ukraine. We've got a bit of Kosovo which is trying to secede from Serbia. We've got a bit of Barcelona, isn't it, or somewhere that's Catalonia, of course, yeah, that's trying to secede from Spain. We've got a bit of Nagorno-Karabakh trying to secede from Azerbaijan. So these various, this seems to be where the United Nations, if they actually want to have a role, should be very active. They don't seem to be very active at all.
Well, I mean, these conflicts are endemic.
A decision needs to be made, doesn't it? It's what I'm saying. Is should people be able to secede or not? How do you decide that?
These conflicts are endemic, and there isn't any easy one-size-fits-all
solution. Referendum, come on.
Yeah, you but who gets to vote in the referendum, Tony?
Everybody in that area.
But they could argue that that's just a minority.
Well, that's what they did in Crimea. Everyone could vote, for
that's
example.
Right. Well, in Kashmir, they voted to leave India, but they've been fighting a war against the Indian government ever since, because the central government won't accept
What's going on here, really, is there's a massive effort, and particularly in Europe, to centralise power. And there's a lot of people out there who would much rather actually not have that power centralised, and so secede, and that seems to be a completely natural reaction of populations to this attempt to centralise power.
There is people have a right under UN rules to secede from as long as it's carried through in a way which everybody can see what the rules are. But the practice of real politics in the real world is that people are quite happy for people to secede from countries they're at war with. But people who try and secede in their own country, not so much. And of course, this is what all the wars in history have been about. Who is going to control this zone? If you look at in European history, the Schleswig-Holstein question, very important question, Tony. There were several wars about it in the 19th century. Shall I bore you with the details? I won't bother. But I'm saying these things are endemic. Look at what's been going on in our own fair isle in Northern Ireland for hundreds of years.
But I mean, for example, Catalonia. If there is a majority, which there is in Catalonia, that want to secede from Spain, why can't they just be allowed to do it? I mean, what's happened is Madrid has been just jailing. The latest on this, by the way, two small Catalan separatist parties currently wield an outsized influence over Spanish politics, as Spain's political parties struggle to form a coalition government after conservative leader Minister Alberto Nunes Feijó failed in his bid on Friday. It's now the turn of acting Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez of the Socialists to try and strike a deal. And of course, in all this political manoeuvring in Spain, this whole Catalan question may be a very important bargaining chip.
Well, it is. They hold the balance of power. But of course, the problem for them is a bit like the SNP in Scotland. They haven't quite got a majority. They're very militant and they want to secede, but there's actually quite a lot of Spanish people who live in Catalonia who don't want to secede. And when they had the referendum, which they had illegally or against the wishes of Madrid, they didn't get a majority. Now, when it comes down to it, there's going to be an argument. Should Spanish people who live in Catalonia be allowed to vote?
Of course.
Well, I would argue that that's the case, but in that case, that you haven't necessarily got the majority you want. But of course, you can bring people in, as the Israelis have brought loads of settlers into the West Bank, and say, we're the majority now. Let's have a referendum.
Well, that's another question.
Well, there you go, isn't it?
Most places
are the loyalists
like
in Northern Ireland? Because they were put there by various British governments over the years.
This is why the Israelis have brought these people in, isn't it?
That's right. So you can say once.
And it's why the British in Ireland.
The argument about who gets to vote in referendums on things like this is quite important. In the aftermath of the First World War, Silesia, for example, voted to leave Germany and become part of Poland. But there was a civil war and people had to change, some people were on the wrong side of the line when it was over. The Valley of Aosta was allowed to leave Italy. These problems are what diplomats spend an awful lot of time arguing about, because every divorce or marriage is in fact unique. Whether people do, because you can have autonomy without having independence.
Marcy, I'm getting a bit fed up listening to you. I think you're overcomplicating. You see, what you do is you just have a referendum. You have a vote, like there probably will be in Northern Ireland about whether they rejoin Southern Ireland at some point. Just do it by a referendum.
And who's allowed to vote in the referendum, Tony? Are the people in Southern Ireland allowed to vote in? Is only the people in Northern Ireland, the six counties of Northern Ireland created, the nine counties of Ulster would have voted.
I think you're actually being silly now.
No, I'm not.
Why on earth would you allow people in Southern Ireland to vote on a referendum about Northern Ireland?
Because Northern Ireland. You just don't do that. The border in Northern Ireland was set down by the British. The nine counties of Ulster have got a nationalist majority.
Who runs Northern Ireland? So you have the vote in Northern Ireland. You're just complicating things deliberately.
No, I'm not complicating things deliberately. People in Kurdistan want to be independent of Turkey, but they've actually agreed, even the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, which has been fighting the NATO forces in Turkey, 30,000 are dead, but they've said, we don't want to be independent, we want autonomy within Turkey. And they've agreed that that's their goal. Now, you can have... Independence means you get a flag and you get a seat at the United Nations. I would argue that Israel should be denied its seat at the United Nations.
Not necessarily. You get your independence, but actually getting your seat at the United Nations might be another step, mightn't it?
Well, that means that in other words, there are more than one step.
Ultimately, if people don't want to be ruled by the people that are ruling them, they should have a chance to vote not to. I think that's just a very basic principle. Let's look at Ukraine, because we're running out of time now. Moscow has announced a massive military spending increases, and also Rand Paul in the United States has said we must withdraw all Ukraine money to avoid a shutdown in America. So they've got this problem with the US budget, with not enough money to pay the civil service in America, and so Rand Paul is saying we need to stop sending money to it. The Russians have got the other basically on the other tip, which is we're actually massively increasing our military spending because we think that this war is going to go further and further.
Well, I mean, we're coming to the crisis point. I mean, obviously, I'm reading a lot about this, not least because it seems I'm now occasionally going to be back on RT, so I need to know what to say.
Military spending is going up in 2024 by nearly 70%, so that's a big increase.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're preparing to fight NATO. And if we're going to fight them, then there's going to be no tax cuts for the wealthy in this country.
When Russia calls it NATO's hybrid war, what do they mean?
What they mean is that everything that's been going on since we took over in Russia in the 1990s has been an attempt to break up the Russian state for the benefit of Western multinationals. But they're wise to that, which is why they've still got a nationalised arms industry, a nationalised energy industry, and they realise that they're not just... They've now basically destroyed three Ukrainian armies. They're getting ready to fight the whole of NATO. And, of course, Keir Starmer is ready to fight them, as is Rishi Sunak, as is Sir Ed Davis. Navy, and the ordinary people in this country have been told, yeah, we're going to improve the health service, we're going to, you know, solve various problems, oh yes, and we're going to have a war with Russia. The people, top level people in the British Army, are coming out and saying the British people don't realise yet that we're going to have to go to war with Russia. We've got to educate them, which I think is absurd.
We have a fascinating bit of news this week, which hasn't got anywhere near the attention I think it should have done, which is relating to the arrest warrant issued by the International Criminal Court for senior Russian leaders. This week we hear Newsweek's reported, and many other people have reported, Russia has issued arrest warrants for the Hague Court judges, that Russia has added International Criminal Court President Pyotr Yosef Khomansky to its wanted list months after the court accused President Vladimir Putin of illegal deportation of children from Ukraine to Russia. Well, of course, the Russians are saying, well, these are just kids caught in the war zone. What are we supposed to do with them? We're making sure they've got some decent homes to go to. Khomansky, his deputy Luz del Carmen, Ibariz Karantsa and Judge Bertram Schmidt are all now wanted under the Russian Criminal Code. Independent Russian news outlet Media Zone has reported on Monday this week, Martin.
Well, the Russians have never been a member of the International Criminal Court, nor has the United States of America. So they just don't recognise it. And if they then try and, persecute what they regard as innocent people in Russia, they're going to issue warrants for their arrest. You know, two people. Who is going to be arrested? Who knows? They better not. They can't travel to Russia now, can they? These people, just as Putin cannot travel to various other countries because he'd be arrested.
They probably don't want to travel to Russia.
Well, indeed, no. But in other words, this is all basically mudslinging. The Russians are saying we're not going to accept your so-called rules-based order, which is just what you say is the rules, and those are supposedly the rules. We're going to stick to the UN Charter, which does have rules about countries that can secede or not secede, and what the basis of it should be. And it's of course these things are complicated. Like the Schleswig-Holstein question.
And finally, China has issued a white paper this week on global community of a shared future, and it's pressing on with its BRI, Belt and Road Initiative, projects. In Beijing, they say, according to the Straits Times, China on Tuesday has unveiled a blueprint for a better world, raised by President Xi Jinping in 2013 through a policy paper on building a global community of a shared future. It said it will continue to push for green developments in the Belt and Road Initiative, rejecting accusations it has outsourced its environmental pollution. A senior official from China's top economic planner said at a press conference on the wide-ranging policy paper about China's global vision. A white paper titled A Global Community of Shared Future, China's Proposals and Actions, comes a decade after the vision was first proposed by President Xi and has been presented as his alternative to the current Western-led world order. Well, the Chinese apparently are thinking well into the future, Martin. The things like the IMF and the United Nations, as they start to fall apart, the Chinese are saying, well, we need something to take their place.
Well, they certainly want to get rid of the IMF. I think the position of the Russians and the Chinese at the moment, they want to reform the United Nations. They see the United Nations as a bulwark against Western policies which are driven by their own selfish interest. But of course they're also prepared, because the United Nations, as you know, is in New York and the Americans are able to manipulate it, they're also saying, well, we need a new security architecture for the whole planet. And, that involves, basically mediation in disputes between countries about borders and all the rest of it. There's got to be some general rules about that. But, of course, at the moment, what we've got is the rules-based order, which is basically America decides what to do, blows up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is an absolutely criminal act, and says, well, yeah, but we can do that.
No, the United Nations don't seem to really make any kind of moves on that at all. Anyway,
well, no, because they haven't got the power to do it.
A lot of this is the 21st century as defined by this amazing 9/11 attacks back in 2001. The Americans trying to use that to dominate things around the world, to invade countries that they want to, such as Afghanistan, Iraq, to topple Gaddafi, this sort of thing, saying there's jihadis lying everywhere. And I'm joined on the line now, I hope, by Matt Campbell, who was with us last week. Matt, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, sir. Matt, because I know you were expecting a decision from the Attorney General on your brother's inquest on Monday, weren't you?
Yes, we'd sent off on the 11th September a sort of pre-application protocol. It's like a warning shot that we're going to litigate against them, and they had until Monday to respond, and our deadline for filing was Tuesday this week. And almost 11th hour, but they got back to us. And I wouldn't say amazingly, because it was one of the potential outcomes, but they have withdrawn their decision to deny my brother's decision to get my brother's inquest reopened, and they're going to make a fresh decision in due course, for us it's a massive result. I think it's an implicit admission that the decision they made back in June this year, after we waited 22 months, basically had no legal basis at all. And they had to back down. What we actually sent them, it was more than sort of the usual skeleton arguments, because we had so little time. We basically front loaded the entire substantive grounds. So it was like a 21 page document. And there's no hiding place for them. And rather amazingly, we've won.
Well done. I mean, where does it all go from here, though? Because you're still going to have to wait for another decision, it seems, from the Attorney General to actually be able to reopen the inquest.
Yeah, that's right. Had a conversation with the barrister, and he's of the opinion that this is a kind of stepping stone to them actually reversing their decision. He said, they sat on it for 22 months. They gave it their best shot with what they gave us back in June. And we know that more senior people have been looking at it. Well, they always do when you threaten litigation. But the response we got back was actually from one of their senior members. And so he's of the opinion that, there's enough people looking at it right now. It's not the way they'd normally do things to, say, mothball it for another year. It makes no sense. So we're kind of expecting something certainly by the end of the year, and obviously we hope a positive decision.
Well, fantastic, isn't it? It's lovely to be able to end the show tonight with some good news like that. And so you're in London, aren't you, for an event tomorrow? Do you want to just talk about that a little bit? Say what's happening and where?
It's at the Pirate Castle in Camden in London, and it's an event that starts at 1:30 in the afternoon, goes on to sort of 6-ish. I'm going to be giving an in-depth update on what's been happening this summer with the legal battles and the judicial review process. Piers Robinson, the propaganda studies expert, is going to be giving a talk. And we're also screening the new Graham McQueen 9/11 researcher documentary called Peace, War and 9/11, which I guess you could call it a London premiere. So, you can get the tickets on Eventbrite. If you search for Matt Campbell, you should find it. Or if not, you can turn up at the door, and I think it's for like £9-10 cash on the door.
Fantastic.
Be great if people could turn up. Still got a few tickets to sell.
Okay, well, look, I was just looking after we spoke to you last week at this whole... there is such a massive amount of evidence of irregularities, if we can put it that way, to do with the September the 11th attacks. And one of the most important ones to me is that it's clear evidence that there was insider dealing going on before the attacks, particularly on the shares of these airlines. People knew that these attacks were going to happen. We're talking about very senior people even somebody associated with the Central Intelligence Agency and the FBI, for example, that knew that something was going to happen. And so they bet that these airline shares were going to go down on the week of the September the 11th attacks, and they made a lot of money, didn't they?
Yeah, those put options, they investigated it and basically said that they didn't have any links to Al-Qaeda, which is their kind of, their test for, clearly it's got nothing to do with the events of September the 11th. We know that, the net is a lot wider than so-called Al-Qaeda. For me, it is an area that, sadly has almost been memory holed. It certainly didn't get the level of scrutiny it should have got if it had ever been in court, because clearly someone knew. There's other examples of foreknowledge, but that was a very good one.
Martin, what do you think the significance of this is?
Well, obviously I don't know as much as Matt does about what the legal significance of this is, but I'd like to congratulate you on your persistence in refusing to accept the lies that we've been told. And when it happened at the time, I was pretty I knew straight away that the state had done it. And I thought at the time it'll take at least 20 years before we get any redress on this, and I wasn't wrong. It has taken 20 years, but hopefully the next 20 years are going to be a different story.
I'll take half of that.
Yeah, quicker yes, the better.
Yes.
Okay, Matt. Where can people follow your? I mean, I suppose a campaign really to get this inquest reopened. Yeah, where's the best place to follow it?
Well, on my Twitter, it's probably easiest. That's MattCampbell911. But for more in-depth updates and just where we're at, ic911.org. That's the International Centre for 9/11 Justice. So ic911.org is probably the best way to follow
okay.
Progress with the case.
Brilliant. Well, thanks very much for joining us at short notice. And also, I'm sure you're going to have a lovely time in Camden tomorrow. Well done.
Yeah. Cheers, Tony.
Thanks Matt. Thank you very much. So that's interesting, isn't it, Martin? And there's, I mean, what did he say? I can't remember how many pages of evidence that they've given to the Attorney General. Finally, it seems that, and it may be because this government's on its way out, that some of the civil servants and the ministers or whatever, the Attorney General specifically, are thinking, well, I mean, let's do something before I go.
Well, I don't know that would be the case. I think actually that legal stuff is very complicated, and it's what you need is barristers who really know their way around the law.
People like Keir Starmer.
Well, indeed.
He'd find a way to throw it out, wouldn't
well,
he?
Well, yes, I'm sure he would. But the point is that the law is a very unwieldy sort of a beast. But, you know, if you've got, I mean, as he said last week, they've had to spend tens of thousands of pounds on this, which they've had to crowdfund. If you didn't have that, you wouldn't have a chance at all.
Well, that's right. We're going to finish up this week with, again, I mean, we'll be having her on almost every week so far, Morgan Marshall from the TikTok star from the US. And here she is talking about Elon Musk. He's just been awarded, I don't know if you saw this, Martin, some massive contract. If I can find out exactly how much he's managed to get. He's got a contract now from the Pentagon. Elon Musk is sort of everywhere, isn't he? He seems to be a kind of ubiquitous character nowadays.
Well, he's always had contracts from the Pentagon, just like Bill Gates and all these other. I mean, you don't get to be a billionaire by not having contracts with the Pentagon. Where do you think the money comes from?
So I suppose I do have to apologise again. We'll have to do the nukes thing next week with Palomares and John Large, and also the case against the nuclear. I mean, this is the John Large interview is pretty shocking about how they're simulating a nuclear accident at Devonport, but we'll have that next week. But we'll finish this week with Morgan Marshall looking at Elon Musk, the transhumanist, and his bizarre antics.
Elon Musk just changed the Twitter logo from its classic bird to an X. An X that, when mirrored, perfectly resembles the Freemason logo. I would think that this was just a coincidence, but that would mean that I would have to believe that all of these logos that represent Freemasonry and satanic symbolism are also coincidences. Which they're not. I truly would love to think that Elon is for the people just how he portrays himself to be, but between his extremely satanic Halloween costume, featuring an upside-down cross and a horned goat that resembles the Baphomet, his suit that he wore to the Met Gala that says Novus Ordo Seclorum, or New World Order, and his SpaceX car that he allegedly sent into space, glitching during a live stream to show that it is actually in a studio, not in space. The explanations for that I saw on Google were ridiculous. But after all those things, I'm starting to question Elon's motives, especially considering he is trying to implant a metal chip into our heads. And now he's creating his own artificial intelligence startup to rival OpenAI, the largest artificial intelligence company out there, whom he already has donated millions to. Why is he so adamant about the progression of artificial intelligence when he himself said that we are summoning the demons with AI?
And with artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon. You know all those stories where there's the guy with the pentagram and the holy water, and he's like, yeah, you sure you can control the demon? Didn't work out.
Could it be that he is following the satanic and New World Order agenda of the Mark of the Beast and transhumanism? And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads. Is he trying to merge man and machine? And just as you saw the iron mixed with baked clay, so the people will be a mixture and will not remain united any more than iron mixes with clay. Is he somehow trying to harness our consciousness with his Neuralink to create immortality? Elon says humans could eventually download their brains into robots. Which sounds a lot like downloading your consciousness to a machine. And in those days shall men seek death and shall not find it, and shall desire to die, and death shall flee from them. If you have your consciousness uploaded onto a computer, how will it ever progress into the afterlife? I don't know about you, but I do not trust Elon, and I will not be getting his Neuralink. But I would love to know what you guys think.
Well, I think you're great, Morgan. You're fantastic. Morgan Marshall there. Her TikTok handle is It's Morgan FR, one word, ITS, Morgan FR, on TikTok. Almost everything she does is pretty spot on, as far as I can see. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also to 9/11 Truth activist, legal activist, over the inquest for his brother, Matt Campbell. Also, of course, sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. And follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips, and actually music. Yeah, music. Any of this good music that the youngsters are listening to, send me that too, please, via our Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full length interviews like several of those tonight, and story links, comment page, our email address is Martin and I's, and you can subscribe to my weekly email list and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. Here's wishing you a relaxing an enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show. Live stream next Friday at 5. God bless. And don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
This is George's Hill. A ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlords, they defied the laws. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. We come in peace, they said, to dig and sow. We come to work the land in common and to make the wasteland grow. This earth divided, we will make whole. So it can be a common treasury for all. The sin of property we do disdain. No one has any right to buy and sell the earth for private gain. By theft and murder they took the lands. Now everywhere the walls rise up at their command. They make the laws to chain us well. The clergy dazzle us with heaven, or they damn us into hell. We will not worship the God they serve, the God of greed who feeds the rich while poor men starve. We work, we eat together, we need no swords. We will not bow to masters or pay rent to the lords. We are free men, though we are poor. You diggers all stand up for glory, stand up now. From the men of property, the orders came. They sent the hired men and troopers to wipe out the diggers' claim. Tear down their cottages, destroying their corn. They were dispersed, only the vision lingers on. You poor take courage, you rich take care. The earth was made a common treasury for everyone to share. All things in common, all people one. We come in peace, the order came to cut them down.
You noble digger.
years old, stand up now, stand up now. You noble diggers, oh, stand up now. The wasteland to maintain, seen cavaliers by name. Your digging does maintain, and persons all defame. Stand up now, stand up now. Your houses they pull down, stand up now, stand up now. Your houses they pull down, stand up now. Your houses they pull down to fright your men in town. But the gentry must come down and the poor shall wear the crown. Stand up now, diggers all. With spades and hoes and ploughs, stand up now, stand up now. With spades and hoes and ploughs, stand up now. Your freedom to uphold, seen cavaliers are bold to kill you if they could, and rights from you to hold. Stand up now, diggers all. The gentry are all round, stand up now, stand up now. The gentry are all round, stand up now. The gentry are all round, on each side they are found. Their wisdom so profound, to cheat us of our ground. Stand up now, stand up now. The lawyers they conjoin, stand up now, stand up now. The lawyers they conjoin, stand up now. To arrest you they advise, such fury they devise. The devil in them lies, and hath blinded both their eyes. Stand up now, stand up now. The clergy they come in, stand up now, stand up now. The clergy they come in, stand up now. The clergy they come in and say it is a sin that we should now begin our freedom for to win. Stand up now, diggers all. Against lawyers and against priests, stand up now, stand up now. Against lawyers and against priests, stand up now. For tyrants they are both, even flat against their oath. To grant us they are loath, free meat and drink and cloth. Stand up now, diggers all. The club is all their law, stand up now, stand up now. The club is all their law, stand up now. The club is all their law, to keep poor men in awe. But they no vision saw, to maintain such a law. Stand up now, diggers all.
Out on a bright May morning like a hero in a song, looking for a place called England, trying to find where I belong. Couldn't find the old flood meadow or the house that I once knew. No trace of that little river or the garden where I grew. I saw town and I saw country, motorway and sink estate. Rich man in his rolling acres, poor man still outside the gate. Retail park and burger kingdom, prairie field and factory farm, run by men who think that England's only a place to park their car. As the train pulled from the station through the wastelands of despair, from the corner of my eye a brightness filled the filthy air. Someone sown a patch of sunflowers, though the soil is sooty black. Marigolds and a few tomatoes right beside the railway track. behind the terraced houses, in between the concrete towers, compost heaps and scarlet runners, secret gardens full of flowers. Lita grows her scented roses right beneath the big jet's path. Bid a fortune for her garden, Eileen turns away and laughs. Rise up, George, and wake up, Arthur. Time to rouse out from your sleep. Deck the horse with sea-green ribbons. Drag the old sword from the deep. Hold the line for Dave and Daniel as they tunnel through the clay, while the oak in all its glory sucks up sun for one more day. Come all you at home with freedom, whatever the land that gave you birth. There's room for you, both root and branch, as long as you love the English earth. Room for vole and room for orchid, room for all to grow and thrive. Just less room for the fat landowner on his ass in his four-wheel drive. Not money and it is not blood. It's limestone gorge and granite fell. It's weald and clay and seven mud. It's blackbird singing from the may tree, lark ascending through the scales, robin watching from your spade, and English earth beneath your nails. Here's two cheers for a place called England, sore abused but not yet dead. A Mr. Harding saw to England, hanging in there by a thread. Here's two cheers for the crazy diggers, now their hour shall come around. We shall plant the seed they saved us, Commonwealth and common ground. The crazy diggers, now their hour is come around. We shall plant the seed they saved as Commonwealth and common ground.